the liturgical framework, and as I just said in that previous meeting, this affects everyone in South Africa. This is also part of our program of an activist parliament to engage with those stakeholders and invite them to come and make presentations to parliament and to be standing as a committee on finance. Just want to make a few remarks. South Africa has number one position in transparency and budgeting. Secondly, this has been the longest slowdown in the economy since 2009. And we are feeling the effects. State finances must be based on sound financial principles. State revenue increased through personal income tax, company tax, up to August 2014, if you go into analysis. Our economy grew since 1994 by 3.2%, according to an economist in South Africa, Dr. Willow Huerta. That is amazing, if you look where we come from. So our engagement today with the stakeholders here, FSC, I believe the Reserve Bank will also be here, and the Parliamentary Budget Office, is a very important exercise to get your inputs, to enrich us, because at the end of the day, it's us in Parliament that must take the decisions that affect the lives of the people. As opening remarks, I declare this topic here open. Other members will join us. Honorable Moai, Chair of the Chambers of Records of Appropriations, is on his way. Honorable Mukara is out of the country. She's the whip of the State Committee for Finance and Appropriations. I believe Honorable Von Brandes is in the hospital. He's also a member of our committee on finance and appropriations. And Honorable Motlashupi was in Botswana for the elections. Not sure if he has returned, because they must compile an international report. He was a member of a monitoring group. FSC, Mr. Gmalu, and your team, we're going to give you 30 minutes to do your presentation. You're welcome.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, honorable members, colleagues. Let me start off by introducing the team that I am with today. On my right is Dr. Ramos Mabugu, who is the director of our research and recommendations program. On my immediate left is Ms. Sasha Peters, who is our program manager for budget analysis, and next to her is Dr. Hamid Amusa, who is our program manager for fiscal policy and macroeconomic policy and public finance. Chair, I think let me skip the first slide because it provides the legislative basis for the submission. The next slide basically provides the background to our submission that we're making today. I think it is important to highlight that the Commission in general welcomes the main themes that are contained in the 2014 medium-term budget policy statement, which resonates very well with the Commission's author mission for the division of revenue for 2015-16, that was to May 2014. In that submission, the Commission raised issues around South Africa's fiscal and economic challenges that are more severe than a lot of people would have realized. according to that submission, the economy is still reeling from the effects of the global economic downturn. Revenue levels are declining and social demands are rising, which means that there are serious trade-offs that have to be made if we have to balance fiscal sustainability and the socio-economic impact of public revenues. And that was the primary theme of the submission that the Commission made. And in terms of the recommendations, some of the key recommendations that we can find resonance with in the NGPS related to carefully selecting the areas on where expenditure can be cut in order to maintain expenditure ceilings that government has determined to maintain in order to rein in the rising cost in public indebtedness. We also raised the issue of maintaining the effective and efficient utilization of the social expenditure system with a few reforms that are basically required. And in that submission, we did highlight some of those, and we see that there is a commitment in that area for government as well in terms of the MTBPS. We encourage participation in the economy to improve equity and also to increase investment in physical infrastructure and innovation. So these key issues basically come through very succinctly in the MTBPS. I mean, there's another set of recommendations there in the slide which can be picked up from our submission. Now, obviously, the Commission welcomes the increased focus on fiscal consolidation. I think the Minister was very clear that we need to speed up that process. In our submission last year, we did highlight the fact that we needed to actually increase or raise the speed with which we are implementing the fiscal consolidation. And I think there is a clear message coming out of the NGPS that is actually the direction that the government is taking. Now, we also raised an issue that there is a need to rebuild some of the fiscal buffers that provided the fiscal space for counter-cyclical measures. I mean, that's in respect of the contingency reserve in particular, which provided space for some of these buffers. Now, there is definitely credibility to the fiscal targets that led to easing sovereign debt downgrade. I mean, if one looks at what was tabled in the budget 2014 in February and the decisions that have been taken to actually ensure that those targets that were presented then are actually adhered to, one can see that there is a certain degree of commitment to the achievement of the fiscal targets that the government has set itself. And that goes a long way towards reassuring your investors and your rating agencies. So there is a commitment to the actual implementation of planned measures to remove waste, inefficiency, and corruption in utilization of public resources across the spheres of government. I think that is something that is to be welcomed. Let me, at this point, Chairperson, hand over to Dr. Amos Mabubu to just highlight some of the specific issues that are contained in our submission, which we have a longer version of it that we submitted a couple of.
Thank you, Honorable Chair. Morning, Honorable Members. Now, this overview slide that we are looking at tracks economic growth prior to the 2014 MTBPS and post MTBPS period. And what we see is that for the projections that are in the 2014 medium-term budget policy statement, growth is now expected to come in at 1.4% growth. And this is compared to 2.7% growth projection in the 2014 budget ending in February. For 2015, again, we see that downgrade in economic growth, where it is expected to come in at 2.5% compared to 3.2% GDP growth in February and in 2016, the growth again has been revised downwards to 2.8% for a 3.6% that we expect in 2014 budget for the economy to get. There is a new figure, that a new year that has been added to the projections, which is for 2017, where economic growth is forecast to come in at 3%. That's a new figure from the figures, a new projection or forecast compared to what we knew in 2014 budget. So those are the main changes in terms of the macroeconomic projections when we compare the 2014 budget and 2014 MGPTS. Substantial downward reduction in economic growth. Now, the pessimism in outlook is essentially driven by two factors from the analysis in MGPTS that we agree with. There are external factors that talk to a slowdown in the Eurozone, which is an important factor for South African economic growth, not just for 2014, 2016, but even when one looks into the past two decades, there is a strong link between growth in the Eurozone area and the fortunes of South African economic growth. Then there are issues around our vulnerability to capital flows as a result of quantitative easing that has come to an end in the United States, and also easing is cooling down of the Chinese economy, which has implications for demand for our commodities, particularly exports in the mineral sector. Now, importantly, there are internal factors that have now begun to dominate external factors impinging on economic growth. So the adverse impacts of labor-related disabilities and the infrastructure bottlenecks, as well as the depressed consumer spending, all began to dominate externally driven forces impacting on economic growth. That is a trend which has begun to change the storyline for our economic growth forecast and projections. That impact external factors were more important in determining our outcomes, but now increasingly domestic oriented factors are the biggest drivers of the downgrade in the economic growth forecast that we have seen to see. We note that a key component in containing a public sector wage bill across the 3 years is actually in line with the Commission's first work. That is emphasis in following the rate of the public sector wage bill and government needing to improve its efficiency and productivity of the workforce. I also emphasize the MGPTS. What the Commission would wish to emphasize for the 2014 MGPTS is that whatever deal is struck between the government and the labor union, it must be a multi-year agreement as opposed to a one-year agreement which brings in stabilization into the fiscal framework. So that's the new caution note for the Commission, that we should continue with multi-year agreements as opposed to one-year agreements, as we have seen in the past that those tend to stabilize the fiscal framework going forward. Continuing with outlook, a key consideration is to look at the growth in GDP forecast and growth in the budget deficit. So one always needs to watch closely the magnitude of growth in budget deficit versus growth in the economy. And if there are discrepancies, that begins to give you clues about where you are going with your accumulation of public debt. Now, when one looks at the growth of the economy compared to growth of the budget deficit, that quite a deficit growth outperforms growth in the economy, which is the opposite of what you want. So the result of growth in the budget deficit outweighing growth in the economy is naturally that public debt outturn is much higher than was anticipated at 2014 budget. And so what one notices from the fiscal framework that they come in as a result of budget deficit growing faster than the downgraded economic growth rate is that the outturn of the public debt is higher than what anticipated in the 2014 budget. And again, that requires a spending on interest payments and on outstanding bonds and other obligations. And we know that interest rates have been historically, even at a historically low level for South Africa, at least in the last 5 years, and that situation is unlikely to continue in the development of the world economy linking up to the stopping of the quantitative easing exercise that I spoke about. So we are likely to experience a low interest rate as we have gotten used to, at least in the last 5 years, meaning that the interest burden on that rising public debt is likely to eat more into available revenues for negotiating economic development than its 2014 budget. Now, the next slide looks at the consolidated fiscal framework, which was to the heart of the request that was made to come and brief the House today on. So we are going to go into slightly more detail on each of those elements of the fiscal framework and give the Commission perspective on each one of the aspects of the fiscal framework from the research and recommendations that we have done. Now, starting with the upper line of the fiscal framework, the macroeconomic outlook with the projected weaker revenue and higher debt service costs has imposed significant costs on the broader fiscal framework. In total, the government is expected to spend 3.947 trillion when the revenue take is sitting at 3.497 trillion. So there is around 5.3 billion shortfall to negotiate during the process from the fiscal framework. And over the 2015 years, we see real annual average growth in expenditure being projected to grow 4.7%, and a relatively stronger 6.8% growth in projected revenue. And the bulk of resources are allocated in respect of non-interest allocations in the form of equitable share and conditional grant funding to the provincial and local areas. Now,
Dr. Ramos, the regional revenue, etc., passed actually to the Appropriations Committee. That you turn to slide 21, coming to the next, because that's our mandate as finance.
Coming to the revenue and tax proposal aspect of the fiscal framework, we compared to our predictions in the 2014 budget when we made a decision on the fiscal framework and revenue proposals, it was in respect of the value added tax slowing down due to a lower consumption. And those predictions now being confirmed in 2014 and in the years. So the fall in that revenue is confirms the improved performance that we saw in the corporate tax revenue in 2014 budget has not been affected, and now a new big problem that is coming is that corporate income tax customs duties are contributing to the overall fall in anticipated revenues, which is a major cause for a concern in the shortfall for the 2014 MTBPS. Now, in the 2014 MTBPS, the Minister of Finance did indicate that in order to avoid low cuts, in other words, austerity in expenditure, then an additional 15 million rand per annum would be required for the rate if we were to avoid austerity as opposed to extended consolidation. Now, our view is that a proposal to tax increases as part of stabilization is probably more preferable as a reasonable tax to pay if we are to avoid going into a deficit, which would be the situation if your economy continues to grow below your budget deficit, as I said at the beginning. We note the intended measures that are left in shortfall experienced by Chevron Enterprises in the MTPS, and we welcome the move towards removing soft budget constraints and encouraging more fiscal prudence, efficiency in operations and resource utilization. But we will await the details of intended sale of non-strategic assets and equity conversion, because the details of those were not discussed in the 2014 MTPS, and we will await all the details before coming up with our recommendations to the House of. There's also the issue of the Deficit Tax Committee that was mentioned in the 2014 MTPS. Up to now, the Commission has not interacted formally with the Deficit Tax Committee, and we are looking forward to interacting with that committee in its proposal for tax reforms as part and parcel of the 15 billion rand per annum shortfall that the Minister spoke to. Now, coming to unallocated resources in the fiscal framework picture, in our 2014 fiscal framework and revenue proposal submission back in February, March, noted that allocations in respect of the unallocated reserves were markedly lower than for budget 2013. Now, MTBPS 2014 continues with this trend, at least for the first 3 years of the 2015 medium-term expenditure framework. But by 2017-18, the amount that is set aside was 45 billion rand. And that 45 billion rand is commendable from the Commission perspective, because it goes along with our recommendations that the buffer must be built up, particularly in this season, which is mired by a lot of uncertainty and instability in the macroeconomic setup. So that 2017-18 figure of 45 billion, which is new compared to 2014 budget, is welcome and resonates well with the recommendation that we made on the previous fiscal framework and revenue proposal in February 2014. Thank you, Chair.
Just to conclude, Chairperson, slide 34 basically summarizes our assessment of the MTPS against our recommendations that we made in the tables in May. And we think there's a fairly decent alignment in terms of the primary things contained in our submission and what we're seeing to emerge from the MTPS. I think the slide 35, the main issue is to re-emphasize the issue of the negative economic growth and support the position scriptures, slide 26, basically it's just to indicate that there has been a review of the local government fiscal framework that the commission has done. There has not been a review of the provincial government fiscal framework. And what we are trying to look at is whether the current situation with respect to the responses that we have seen coming out of the global economic crisis, how local government and provincial government have been affected, whether the existing fiscal frameworks for provinces and for local government are robust enough to actually assist that. Most of the things that have been happening with respect to the provincial sector or sphere is that we've been managing expenditures and we have not been doing much in the form of what provinces must be doing with respect to contribution to economic development outside of implementing programs in the social let me say social sector programs, which is primarily education, health, and social development, which is in terms of function of assignment, not necessarily exhaustive of the functions that provinces must actually be performing. So that is something that we're putting on the table for future. Let me stop here, Chairperson, and thank you for the opportunity to brief the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Kumalo, and your team. On the members, we will go straight to the second presentation by the PBO. The Reserve Bank is on their way. The delegated person, Chris Lowell, I believe he's landed and must go to Parliament. Professor Jahed, you will instruct, we will do the presentation. Welcome. And also thank you in what you are doing as a PBO to assist the relevant committees, but also referring to other committees in Parliament. Your mic is not on.
Hello. Chair, thank you very much. My colleagues will do the initial presentation and then we'll allow an opportunity to engage with you later on the presentation that you made, Chair. Thank you very much.
Welcome also to the members that joined us during the meeting.
Chair, can I just point out that Therese Van Rooyen is stuck in a strategy meeting. Tiny Tobias Pokoro is on the front right. She wasn't particularly disposed up till yesterday. But
you're ready, you may take off. We will also give you 30 minutes.
Good morning, Chairpersons, honourable members. Can we start? Yeah. I think our presentation has been circulated. Okay, thanks for the opportunity to make input on the medium-term budget policy statement. I think this is the first time that the PBO has been in a position to make a more substantive contribution to this process. Okay, this is just an outline of our presentation. I went well on it. We're going to deal with a number of issues. Just a sort of reminder that the Money Bills Act came in 2009, empowered Parliament to actually make amendments to money rules, which potentially changes the nature of oversight. And the PBO, our key role is really supporting Parliament in considering the details of money rules, including presenting to the budget and MTP process in order to inform the committee's decision on those issues of legislation. Our presentation aims to identify and analyze key issues in the MPPS and revised fiscal framework. And I think one of our challenges for the Parliament committees will be the strategic use really of PBO resources to support implementation of the Money Bills Act. Just to give an example, the Act potentially allows the committee to introduce two reports, one on the 2014-15 fiscal framework and one on the proposed fiscal framework, which is sometimes called the NCPS. Given the time constraints the committee faces, that might be something to look into in future years. Just to move on to, so this should give you an overview of our presentation, so you essentially know where we're going up front, and then we'll get into the details, and I'll bring in my colleagues for the relevant sections. So the driving force behind the NCPS this year is the fact that the growth outlook has been revised downwards. The projected growth rates members are now aware of, in particular the fact growth has been reduced down to 1.4% in 2014-15. In addition, what the minister has proposed is reducing spend levels and increasing revenue collection in order to maintain the debt cost that was committed to in the 2014 budget. In order to do that, as I've already mentioned, as Rick has also mentioned, that the intention of collecting revenue, we will see in the 2015 budget how that's going to happen. But in addition, expenditure ceilings have been lowered. As I must emphasize, it's not quite the same as cuts, but essentially the planned increases in expenditure forecast from the budget now being reduced. And the consequences of this reduction have been spread proportionally across spheres. At this stage, you can't say too much about what's going to happen in particular at provincial level because provinces still need to table their plans and budgets next year. But we can say something about what will happen at national level, and we'll get into those details later. Besides, obviously, the vulnerability of the plan to growth forecasts. So in other words, if growth does recover to the levels envisaged by National Treasury, then further measures will need to be taken, whether it's allowing debt to increase or further reducing expenditure ceilings and improving revenue. But leaving that aside, other potential risks relate to actually the ability of states to implement the cost stabilizing measures that are envisaged. The prospects for revenue collection, whether Treasury will in fact be able to design and implement those successfully. Another key issue really is the role of SREs in public entities, and that lies in two forms. One is in the assumption that some of the expenditure can potentially be put back by reducing transfers to these entities. But a separate issue is reducing the risk to the balance sheet reducing the risk of the fiscus by going for this deficit neutral approach to funding state entities. In other words, making sure that whatever money is given to state entities to support their balance sheets, the government first receives into the National Revenue Fund. So that's a key strategy, but really that will be in the detail of the implementation. And then finally, another issue that members are well aware of is public sector wages, both in terms of the actual the headcount of public sector employees, but also the nature of the wage settlements that take place in that area. And the minister has been quite clear that if wage settlements exceed inflation plus 1 or 6.6%, then that's what has to happen in order to maintain this debt part. So these are the issues we're going to deal with. And now I'll go to my colleague, Rashad, to talk about the growth outlook and other relevant macro-sectoral details.
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. Honourable people, since 2009, Zambia's growth performance is disappointing significantly. And in fact, the forecast for this year, the rise forecast of 1.4% is down from 2.7% National Treasury forecasted in February of this year. If it has realized, will be the third worst year since democracy. I mean, the other two bad has been 97 and 2009 would be actually contracted. So it is quite significant. If we look at this graph, back in 2012, the MTP just 2 years ago, we forecast 3.8% for 2014. That's been revised downwards 1.4. So it's very significant. And the survey has taken on year after year with every MTPS and budget. The first quarter, we contracted by 0.6% of this year. Second quarter, we expanded by 0.6%. And so, as a consequence, the outlook for this year is rather poor. The first half year, we only grew 1.3%. And this should be driven, economists will struggle to completely comprehend and understand economic growth. But some of the key drivers are both domestic and international. International, notably, the continuing effects of the recession and financial crisis of 2009, as well as a rather tepid recovery in Europe, and as you also mentioned, our key trading partners, China and Europe, slowing down. Added to that, is commodity prices have been rather low, and we're commodity exporting country, and these relevant to the rest of the world, which are largely out of our control, drive our performance. At the same time, there are also domestic factors driving our performance. Earlier this year was the five-month strike that began in January in the platinum sector. And this affected not just output of the platinum sector, but also output of manufacturing because of forward and backward linkages. And so we need to consider sectors have ripple effects. What the graph also shows is the NDP target of 5.4% for us to rely on development goals, significantly higher than what's been expected in most recent NDPs. And this is a rather important point of consideration, especially given that the fiscal package which we can decide right now that needs to be implemented, and NDP goals, the NGSF goals need to be realized in a more constrained environment. However, we also mentioned that Africa is an integrated part of the global economy. And if you look at 2009, our performance, as well as the performance of our peer countries, have been affected negatively by developments in Europe and North America. At the same time, our outlook is not as rosy as some of our BRICS countries and also Africa's large economy, Nigeria, right now. At the same time, countries like Brazil is facing similar structural issues and vulnerabilities to global capital flows. Their outlook somewhat as bad as ours, so is Russia. So, in a sense, we're not exceptional in this poor performance, given international developments. At the same time, the domestic issues that affect us, domestic issues are those that you do have some, as committees responsible for oversight, and as national government and provincial and local governments have some sort of exercise and control over. So even the poor outlook, national treasury, with the objective of narrowing the budget deficit, stabilizing debt, rebuilding fiscal space, and broadly reinforcing sustainability, has proposed a fiscal package, and this graphic is intended to simplify components of the fiscal package. The two key components, first the reduction in non-interest expenditure ceiling, so slowdown in growth and spending, essentially, which my colleagues will touch on later on this presentation, combined with an increase to raise additional revenue of $27 billion. This is intended through adjustments in tax policy administration, and details will be provided in 2015 budget. The intention of this is to reduce the budget deficit, and you can see those three blue dots in the bottom right-hand corner, going from 3.6% for 2015-2016 down to 2.5% by 2017-2018. The budget deficit, which is what National Treasury is slightly concerned about, obviously narrowing the budget deficit, and we can see from this half, at least in man terms, a growing budget deficit. And today it's far worse in terms of grand value than what it was a few years ago. And the budget deficit, which National Treasury through increasing expenditure from 2009 onwards, has been in response to the global financial crisis and its effect on this country, essentially slow growth. So the idea is expansionary fiscal policy, countercyclical fiscal policy is intended to stimulate the economy. However, the effects of this haven't been as positive as expected, and so National Treasury is of the contention that sustainability becomes an issue and there needs to be a slowdown in this policy. Debt has also been an issue, reducing the country's debt levels. And the idea is to reduce debt going forward. So this is a projection of debt going forward. You can see interest payments have increased. An increase in debt is primarily to fund the expansionary policy. And my colleague, Sean, would like to talk to you about the change in debt.
This is a figure taken from the NDPS itself. What we've done actually is use the IMF's official definition of emerging countries and add one additional bar. The comparison made for National Treasury was intended to show that it's not just the level of debt to GDP, it's also how our debt to GDP ratio has been changing over time since the financial crisis. And what we see really is that our African ratio has been changing much more dramatically than other countries in terms of increasing debt. All this graph shows is that the NDPS proposals will ensure that that change in debt to GDP ratio over those 8 years from 2009 to 2017 decreases very significantly, so it's going from first bar to the second bar. I want to get back to the point talking about how National Treasury intends to achieve that. And this is why I talked to this slide specifically. I just want to say something about the fiscal framework 2014-15. Because our submission really deals with the medium-term budget policy statement proposals as a whole, of which 2014-15 is really one component. in the current year, the decline in the growth output that Rashad has been talking about has resulted in reduced revenue collection, which Brandon will talk about, my colleague Brandon will talk about shortly. As a consequence, governments had to find a way of trying to maintain its debt path. And the way it's done that is by, first of all, there has been under expenditure already in the current financial year, and is projected to be even greater under expenditure. That's not going to be allocated elsewhere, and in addition, the ICAP unallocated reserves are also not going to be allocated to other expenditures. So, in the current financial year, governments have found a way to try and maintain the debt path, at least more so than would have been the case if it had just allowed the reduced revenue collection to keep through. Okay, so I just want to say that about this year's revised fiscal framework. When it comes to the issue of how Treasury envisages the reduction in the expenditure ceilings taking place, and this comes from the commitments in the NCBPS policy statements, these will take place in proportion to the current division of revenue. Okay? So the expenditure ceilings will be reduced by the amount by which they will be reduced will be divided across provinces, 44% of the amount, local governments 9%, and national 47%. As I said earlier, we don't know exactly how provinces will deal with this yet until we get to budget 2015, but we do have policy commitments in the NCBPS on how government will deal with this at the national level. And there are three particular steps envisaged, all of which come with particular merits, but also risks. One of these is to reduce spending on non-essential goods and services. So that should account for 40% of the reduced expenditure ceiling at national level. And obviously, as we signaled already, that depends on department's capacity to actually implement these cost-containing measures. 40% is envisaged to come from reductions in the planned transfers to public entities. Okay, and it remains to be seen which those public entities are. That's obviously important in terms of assessing performance and service delivery. So that remains to be seen in budget 2015. And then finally, a removal of funds allocated to vacant posts. And again, although National Treasury has indicated a desire that this does not affect frontline service delivery, that will depend on exactly how these cuts are implemented at the national level. Okay, I'll skip over to my colleague Brands for other assumptions and risks. Yes.
Thank you, Sean. So the remainder of the presentation is going to provide an analysis of the fiscal package proposed in the 2014 GDPS, which is embodied in the revised or proposed fiscal framework. So specifically, we've identified a range of assumptions underpinning growth forecasts in the proposed fiscal framework. We're going to elaborate a little bit on those in the following slide. I know some of the assumptions are already touched on, so I'll move through them fairly quickly. Firstly, there's an assumption underpinning the fiscal framework that assumes South African economic performance will improve over the medium term. And that's broadly in line with the assumption that global economic recovery will occur, specifically with regards to our key trading partners, which should boost exports in key sectors. Improve the electricity supply and logistics, the removal of bottlenecks, we've got additional capacity coming online in the next few years. Improve labor environments, there's an assumption that industrial relations will improve, will have less sites, less jobs and productivity, less reduction in wages. There's also the assumption that there'll be increased supply of skilled labor, as well as the implementation of the MTSF and NDP aligned to the objectives. So those are just the assumptions underpinning the proposed fiscal framework. However, those assumptions are also imposed risks in the sense that they may not be upheld. What we will do in the following slides is just touch on some of these risks I'm going to mention now. Firstly, the ability to borrow. There's a pretty substantial risk that in the future that we may receive a credit downgrade. There's the potential that we lose our investment grade status. This would obviously raise financing costs for the state. As Sean's already touched on, wage for personnel numbers, so that's both your headcount and your cost of living adjustments. There are risks associated there. Your SOE performance, potential for SOE to require further capitalization over the medium term, and inability perhaps to stick to the fiscally neutral stance of the fiscal package. And in government's debt portfolio, there's certainly the risk that as we redeem some of our debt in the future, we might be doing so in a higher interest rate environment, and that would add up with the to our interest payments. So what are the implications? Well, worst case scenario, if a lot of assumptions are not upheld, there's implications for growth. Lower growth means lower revenue, means we run higher budget deficits. We have to borrow more, increase our national debt, which results in interest payments. And that all that does is reduce the space for us to stimulate the economy. And that further emphasizes the need for the NTSF and NDP to be implemented within, unfortunately, within constrained fiscal environment. So, especially the importance of oversight and a need to ensure that for money. So I'm going to touch on now revenue collections. I mean, this slide speaks specifically to revenue collections for the current financial year. As you can see, what you can see on the slide is the 2014 budget review estimated national revenue for the current financial year will grow by 8.59%. You can see that by the red dotted line there. What I've done is I've taken a comparison of the revenue collection for each month of this financial year and compared it to the revenue collections for each month of the previous financial year. And what we see is that for the financial year to date, we've actually got revenue growth 6.88%, which is somewhat lower than the 8.59% predicted. But this is recognized in 2014 MTDPS, when they actually revised the growth in revenue down to about 7.96%. And they now estimate a 10 billion rand shortfall in gross tax revenue. So that's really captured there. The table then takes one step further and actually presents four possible budget deficit outcomes for the following year, for the current financial year. The outcomes are based on two possible revenue collection scenarios and two possible real GDP scenarios. So the two GDP scenarios, the first assumption is that GDP will grow by 2.7%, the second scenario that it will grow by 1.4%. And then your two revenue scenarios are that we will achieve the 7.96% revenue growth in MTDS, and the other scenario is that we will continue on our path as we are now and grow revenue by 6.88%. As you can see, the worst-case scenario, that if our revenue continues to grow at its current rate and the economy grows 1.4%, our main budget deficit will be 5.04%, which is marginally higher than what is currently forecast. So turning to the proposed fiscal package, the 2014 MTBS outlines plans to raise an additional 27 billion rand in revenue over the next few years. The document proposes that this will be achieved by enhancing the progressive character of the fiscal system, improving tax efficiency, and realizing structural improvements in revenue. So we thought it might be useful to propose some of the additional revenue options or tools available to the state. In order to do so, because as we know, the MTBS document did provide a tremendous amount of detail on exactly how that will be achieved. What we do know is that the recommendations emanating from the Labour Tax Committee will be fairly significant in informing those options. So firstly, you've got an option to adjust your personal income tax brackets. I mean, that may take the form of a kind of broad adjustment, or more likely adjustments to your higher marginal tax brackets. Theoretically, an adjustment to your upper tax rates would be theoretically co-redistributed, in the sense that you would take money from rich households to spend on programs to serve poorer households. It may mean that this would sort of narrow the inequality gap in South Africa. On the other hand, it might actually result in the long run a reduction in personal income tax. Theoretically, you might suggest that increasing marginal tax rates might incentivize more leisure activities and more tax avoidance behavior. So these are just the merits and risks associated with each of these options. The second option would be increasing your value-added tax. VAT is tax on consumption rather than productive behavior. Some people suggest that because VAT is a flat rate, it may not distort your choices between various products, so it might be more desirable. On the other hand, VAT potentially hits your poorer households more than other households because they spend a higher proportion of their income on consumption expenditure, so that may be undesirable. Your wealth tax, there's a proposal perhaps that you can increase your wealth transfer duties or perhaps a once-off for an annual wealth tax, again transferring wealth from richer households to poorer households. Again, this may be redistributive. It may also incentivize your rich households to move money offshore or engage in tax avoidance behavior. Increasing the corporate tax rates, we know the MTDPS highlighted the fact that the statutory tax rate of 28% is not currently being collected from most companies, and this may partially be due to some tax avoidance behavior. It suggested that raising corporate income tax, that may be an option. It's probably one of the easier options. Some of the risks associated with that. It's quite easy to pass corporate income tax onto consumers, in which case it may actually affect your poorer households more. It also may incentivize businesses to establish a standard operation, which could potentially limit employment opportunities. Closing loopholes and anti-tax avoidance measures. I mean, this is a fairly straightforward proposal. This is not new. This has been an ongoing objection of the state. This could be pursued in conjunction with any of these options. So, our feeling is that it's unlikely to reach significant gains in the very short run. However, it's definitely an option.
Members, just to add an oversight point of view, as Honourable De Beers already indicated, this is a critical issue for these two committees in the coming year, because the revenue proposals, at least the initial content, will be provided in the 2018 budget, and then they will come to the committees in the form of either substantive policy proposals in the taxation amendment bills or taxation law amendment bills, and potentially the rates bill, if the decision is made to change, for example, value-added tax or income tax thresholds. So it's going to be a key issue for oversight in the coming year. So that's the one issue we want to focus on. The other issue is on enterprises and public entities. There are three important issues. My colleague from China is going to talk to some specific analysis he's done this week, but there are three important issues coming out of the FBPS. First, reduction in planned transfers to public entities. Second, change in the nature of balance sheet support. And finally, the proposal for a new policy framework which will distinguish between the commercial mandate, say, an enterprise and developmental mandate. And this is also critical for other committees in this parliament, but also for this committee in terms of assessing performance. Because one of the challenges over the last 20 years has been assessing whether public enterprises are struggling because they are underperforming on their commercial mandates or because they are overcommitted on their developmental mandates. And that's obviously a critical issue for funding. There are a number of risks or apparent risks in terms of the policy proposals that have been made in the MSBPS. For example, it suggests it's a reduction in transfers to public entities with cash reserves. On the basis of that sounds like a sensible proposal, but obviously that assumes that cash reserves are either a proxy for the entities having adequate funding or the proxy for performance in the sense that they're obviously not spending the money they have and therefore transfers should be reduced. But in a worst-case scenario, what we could end up doing is in fact reducing transfers to entities that are being prudent in their spending. So there are always risks involved. There are also potential risks to the envisaged process for balance sheet support. So in particular, the MSBPS seems to have outlined a process whereby the state identifies an enterprise that requires balance sheet support, then identifies some non-strategic assets, to use that phrase, that can be sold, and then only once the revenue from the sale of those assets has been received in the National Revenue Fund will this balance sheet support be provided. Now, that's desirable since that it ties the state's hands from overcommitting to balance sheet support and thereby threaten the debt forecast. But on the other hand, if some of these SOEs is genuinely in a difficult state, it may potentially force the state to sell some of its assets at below market value if for some reason it needs to get that financed in a short period of time. So that's just a potential risk. But the move to identify and separate commercial and developmental mandates is welcome. I think the real issue emerging from the MSBPS is quite a lot more analysis is required, and my colleague Zumsani has already done some, and we will be doing more over the next 6 months, I think.
Thanks, colleagues. Another chair, just a quick zoom. I think Sean on slide 11 mentioned the 40% indicated by the breakdown indication of the furniture expansion, which go to transfers and public entities as well, which I included there as well. But we did a high level overview analysis on the state financial position of some of the key public entities, which most of the information is public information. So we get their financial report and what they try to assess whether they are in any stage to deal with the actions or whether they are in any stage to themselves substitute as suggested in Albania's in the budget policy document. Just below that slide, which shows the answer there. But in the slide before, I'm giving some analysis or summary of the figure there. Many of the key state owned entities, I think the focus here just highlight was mainly on the section 2 entities which are more engaged in commercial activities as opposed to section 3 entities there. So many of the entities seem to have cash reserves in their which suggests that could give pressure on the fiscal if the discussion is to be imposed there. But of course, that is unlikely to change. So I've read some of the few entities that they have, you see them in the list there. And also, there seem to be some key ones which are struggling with meeting their debt commitments, meeting their short-term commitments, which is such that their liquidity could be in trouble. They can't meet their cash obligations in a short term, which would also create a discord around the reduction in allocation to entities. The third also suggests that one of the suggestions was to say the entities would probably be expected to go out there and source out finances to as opposed to relying on the state to save. But now some indications there is that not many of them are able to do that. No matter if they source outside, it's an expected some assets that you should use to as collateral or as a form of taking that finance. Some of them have a better negative ranking in terms of whether they have enough assets to back their long-term finance from extra factors, which also is a discussion with regards to the reduction in terms of debt. And one of the points as well that I try to highlight there is that there's issues on the government structures that are currently unstable, which will probably also create a problem for entities if these are sustainable going forward there. So there's a detailed analysis there on the second slide, which I have indicated what does the red screen mean. But in a simple sense, red means it's bad, you know, and yellow, it means it's alarming and green, it's in a very reasonable state thereof. So please go for that in time. But in summary, there should be greater discourses around the discussion and the information that we have in the entities. Because the product picture is what entities are able to enhance government product mandate to deliver service and so on. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jane. Chair, I think we probably need to start wrapping up. That's not so much of a problem. Many of the remainder of the slides in our presentation are more directed at issues of appropriations. Those are relevant to the committee in as much as the change in the expenditure ceilings require changes in the allocations to the spheres and particular votes. So I guess the main issue we would look at the committee's attention is the fact that the assumption that those can be carried out may occur at the appropriations level, but it has relevance to the plausibility of the proposed fiscal framework. One of the issues we're going to talk to is the wage bill. As you know, this is a risk. PBO has done some initial analysis on what the implications of the current proposal are and some areas where improvements could possibly be made. We know that the FFG and Public Service Commission are also doing an analysis, and I think we'll provide more detailed information as we approach budget 2015. As the committee is aware, one of the critical issues is the alignment of expenditure and the budget to the NDP and the MCSF. We have really briefed the Standing Finance Committee on the MCSF, and we can also do that for the Select Finance Committee. There's a clear intent to link the MPPS to the MCSF, but at this stage it's very hard to really comment on the details because, as we mentioned to the in the previous presentation, the Standing Finance Committee, and you'll see in the final bullet points on the slide, national and provincial departments will submit strategic plans for the period 2015 to 2020 to Parliament and provincial legislatures by February 2015, incorporating relevant actions and targets. So we'll only really be able to compare the detail of alignment in the MCSF, in the MPPS proposals and the MCSF come February next year. This is a breakdown of expenditure by a function group by the MPPS. Spending priorities, I'm not going to dwell on that, can we move past that as well? Move past that too. Just to stop this slide, because this is an issue obviously for really the country at large, the job creation, and in particular for these standing finance committees' oversight over some of the relevant entities. There have been a number of attempts by government to engage in employment creation, not just through employment public sector employees, but actually generating employment creation in the economy. For example, the Job Fund, the Expanded Public Works Program, and various other initiatives. It's been quite notable, a number of members noted this in the Minister's presentation, that the Job Fund underspent quite heavily in the current financial year, and that's something that needs to be looked at. But I think it's also important, this is a point made in the NDP and it's made in other areas, there's a lot of need really for a learning state. So the government, with the best of intentions, are trying to induce job creation in the economy, but we need to keep an eye on these programs, and if they're not working, consider possibly shifting the funds elsewhere. Opportunities for enhanced effectiveness.
You've got 1 minute.
Sure. again, this is more an appropriations issue. We just draw attention to some of the things arising in relation to appropriations from the MGPS, but as I said before, most of the detail will only actually come in the 2015 budget, so I'll skip ahead. Okay, the conclusion really is we're ending where we began. The National Treasury's budget proposal is not radical in and of itself, because really what they're proposing we do is just adjust expenditure estimates and revenue projection in order to stay in line with projections from the 2014 budget. But their hand is enforced by the change in the economic growth outlook. But nevertheless, there are risks that come with the particular proposals, whether relevant to SOEs or revenue collection or the capacity of the different spheres to reduce expenditures and visits. So these are the things that the committee will need to look at, particularly in budget 2015. But there's sound rationale for the proposals relating to the fiscal framework. And as I say, it appears to be really an issue of monitoring the feasibility of the proposals going forward to early next year. Thank you.
Thank you. Honourable members, I consulted with our chair, Karim, that we take the Reserve Bank presentation as well, and then go into discussion. Or if you need a council break after that presentation, just indicate to me. Mr. Lewald, welcome in Cape Town. Yeah. When leaving Johannesburg to Cape Town, it's very, we propose that you take the 4:45 flight, because traffic is a serious problem getting over Tambo and from Cape Town Temple to Parliament.
Yes. Yes.
My sincerest apologies. We were the same. Honourable members, do you have the presentation in front of you? The hard copy? As indicated, if you don't have it, we'll give you 30 minutes.
Thank you.
And thank you for attending this particular.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting us. And apologies for being late. I will go through the presentation quite quickly. I'm aware that members have seen similar sorts of presentations recently, so I will go through it relatively quickly and just draw your attention to specific issues that I think merit your attention at this stage. I'm providing a macroeconomic overview, and I have made some slight changes last night to the presentation that you have before you, but they are pretty minor. So let me just start by pointing out what's probably fairly obvious to all of you, which is that global outcomes in the economy, the global economy, are slowly improving, really very slowly, unfortunately. There are areas like the U.S. economy and Germany, which are those upper two lines in this chart that I've got here, which have done reasonably well. By 2011, they had already surpassed their point in 2008 of production. Whereas much of the rest of the world's advanced economies, which you can see below the line, below that middle line, are still doing rather poorly. Like many emerging markets, South Africa has, our growth rate has trended lower since 2010. And so we will, if you cast your minds back, you will remember that in the wake of the initial crisis, the economy of South Africa as well as other emerging markets bounced back quite quickly. But then since then, there's been this slow, gradual slowing in output across emerging markets. The IMF's growth forecast, which were released a couple of weeks ago, also show this. So if you look at the world in 2014, they expect 3.3, and that's down from 3.5. 2015 is a bit of a bounce back. But generally speaking, the IMF has tended to be, over the last 4 or 5 years, been marking down their growth rates and their expectation for growth in the coming year. This shows that a bit more clearly. You can see on the left-hand side, this is a collection of emerging market growth forecasts, less China. And what these lines just show you is how over time, as new forecasts have been produced by the IMF, they keep getting marked down. And the same is true for South Africa. You can see South Africa is the only country on the right-hand side. And again, while there was an expectation in the wake of the crisis that the economy bounced back quite quickly, you can see that that has not been fulfilled. And the 2014 forecast is that bottom brown line on the far right-hand side. So you can see how far we've gone to. So it's a couple of years ago, we thought we'd grow at 4, and now we're well above 3. With global demand softer, this has affected the prices for South Africa's exports. And so what I've shown you here is the commodity terms of trade and our general terms of trade, including gold. And what this chart shows is just how export prices over import prices have weakened in recent times, particularly since 2011. So for every unit of exports for South Africa, we're getting less than we did before. Unfortunately, there's not a lot of relief in sight. So this chart just shows you market forecasts for main commodities, including platinum, iron ore, gold, and coal, all of which are exploited by South Africa. And you can see that we're not likely to go back up to those peaks we had before. Iron ore is the one exception here, but I think it's I would be wary of taking too much comfort from that forecast. Forecasts are notoriously wrong, particularly when they go as far out as this one does. These go to 2024. And so for the short term, certainly in the medium term, we shouldn't expect a lot of relief on the prices side. Moving to more fully into the domestic economy, credit extension by banks has been subdued, as you can see, especially to households, so that's your red line. You can see that credit extension had picked up reasonably well from 2011 and into 2013, but then started to moderate quite substantially and have continued to moderate through 2014. Companies, however, have done reasonably well, so there's been quite a lot of credit extension to companies. In particular in 2014. This reflects the growth in household consumption spending, which has also been moderating steadily. This just shows you the quarterly growth rates in household consumption expenditure over a number of years. And you can see that essentially since 2011, also 2010, there's been this kind of gradual decline in the rate of growth in household spending. Part of the reason for that is that household debt still remains fairly high. And so if you think about a household being worried about which way interest rates might go, which way inflation might go, you can imagine them being pretty cautious about what they want to do with the cash flow that they have. What we've seen them do over the last few years is try to reduce the household debt levels a little bit, and that's that upper blue line. So from about 83% of disposable income, it's fallen down to about 73%, and that's actually quite a significant drop. But our household debt levels are still, as you can see, well above the kind of long-run average that we had, say, in the 2000s, when we were sitting at about 56-55% of household disposable income. Debt service cost is the red line, and that shows you, again, what you would know, which is that with interest rates easing and inflation being staying roughly where it is, interest rates, and we've been able to keep them quite low, and so debt service costs for the debt burden that households put there has remained historically low. The economy, of course, has also suffered from a series of supply shocks. You all be very familiar with them. The red columns on the right-hand side of the chart show you the quarterly numbers that we generated. So 2014, well, there was a big shock in third quarter of 2013, as you can see. That's the first red column. And then on the right-hand side, the first quarter and second quarter outcomes for this year. To give you a sense of how big these shocks have been relative to other parts of the economy, the graph on the left just shows you the red dotted and blue dotted lines of the manufacturing and mining sectors where the strikes have occurred. And you can see the rest of the sectors have continued to grow at a moderate and reasonably steady pace. All of this has had an impact on real fixed capital formation, so this is investment, which started to weaken really quite sharply late in 2013 and by 2014 had contracted. As you will also know, the unemployment rate has fluctuated around 25% level for some time, so we're not creating a lot of net new jobs relative to the inflow of labor into the labor force, and as reflected in this unemployment rate. And all of this impacts on the bank's GDP forecast. So for 2014, at this stage, we have 1.5%, and what's useful to compare that to where we thought we would be in November 2013. So 1 year ago, we expected the economy for this year to grow at 3%, so twice as fast as it actually did or as we're expecting it to. 2015, we marked down as low as 2.8%, 2016, 3.1%. These forecasts will be slightly different in our next MPC meeting. Well, they may be slightly different in our next MPC meeting coming up in a few weeks' time. One of our vulnerabilities that we pointed out on a reasonably regular basis is our current account deficit, which is large and persistent. This gives you a sense of what it looks like over a long period of time. So this goes back to 2003. And you can see over the boom period of the last decade, this current account deficit built up as the economy heated up and we pulled in lots of imports. Then the crisis resulted in a near collapse of current account balance, so imports collapsed in particular. And then subsequent to that, we've seen a build-up yet again of current account balance up to 6.2% for the second quarter of 2014. Swings in the current account tend to be driven by the trade account. So I mentioned the role of exports and imports in these numbers. You can see this quite clearly here with the sort of navy blue line or royal blue lines, the merchandise export balance, merchandise balance, and you can see that that is quite largely negative and has grown in recent years quite substantially. The reason for that is very simply that imports are consistently outpacing exports, so this is normal growth in exports and imports, and you can see merchandise imports as the red line growing considerably faster in value than more than merchandise exports over a considerably long period of time, but in particular since 2011. At the same time, global inflation is trending down. And so if we compare South Africa, which is the red line, against the black, which is emerging market economies, and the blue is advanced economies, you can see that one of the basic components of our competitiveness going forward is actually worse than our trading partners. Our inflation rate is near the top of the target. We obviously had a good outcome of very recently going down 5.9 to 6.4. But it's still quite high. It's at the top of the target. And core inflation, which is CPI less food and energy, has continued to trend up. Again, the latest figure moved down slightly, but the trend upward is quite clearly there. We think inflation has peaked in Q2 of this year, 6.5%. But we expect further volatility. And the volatility really expected to continue from food, non-alcoholic beverages and petrol prices. And you can see that on the right-hand graph. You can see the dotted blue line, which is food and beverages. You can see how jumpy that is around the headline CPI number. So our inflation forecast is quite simply an average of 6.2% for this year. We think it peaked at 6.5% in Q2. For 2015, we think it will average 5.7% and return to within the target range in the first quarter of the year. And that's an improvement on the forecast compared to the previous MPC meeting, two MPC meetings ago, where we thought it would only come back within the target in the second quarter of this year. For 2016, we think the headline CPI will average 5.8%. And just to underscore the point about the stubborn stickiness of the core inflation measure, we've got it at 5.6% on average for 2014, 5.7% for next year, so it's a rise before moderating somewhat to 5.5% in 2016. Our rate hiking cycle has been quite moderate in comparative terms, so this just shows you where South Africa stands relative to Brazil, Turkey, Russia, Indonesia, Colombia, India, Malaysia, Mexico, and Chile. Mexico and Chile are the two economies here who have actually cut rates this year. Everybody else since May 2013 has raised rates quite a lot. South Africa has gone up by 75 basis points, as you know. Brazil has gone up by nearly 400, Turkey well over 300, Russia nearly 300 basis points. So within the emerging market universe, there's been quite a shift towards a hike in interest rates. The SOG, of course, has tried to balance inflation and world interest rates with the weak domestic economy, and this just shows you over a long period of time what our current rate hiking cycle has looked like compared to previous ones. So if you look at, say, 2006 to 2007, 2008, that big circle right in the middle of your graph, you can see that our rate hiking cycle is quite steep and extends for quite some time. And we have made two small changes over a relatively speaking longer period of time. The difficulty is that global pressures are mounting, and the ECB and the Federal Reserve are shifting their policy stance as we speak. The Federal Reserve is expected to continue to normalize its policy stance. It announced the other day that it will no longer buy assets in their markets, and so they will not be pumping more liquidity into global markets. The European Central Bank is going in the opposite direction. So the European Central Bank is expected to increase its balance sheet, which is the graphite chart tree on the left. So ECB is the light blue line, and you can see that they increased balance sheet very sharply during the crisis, and then they unwound it quite sharply up to 2014. And now they've set a new target for 1 trillion euros, which is that blue dot above. So we expect the ECB to start buying assets and putting euros into the market. As these things happen, the US dollar and euro tend to change directions, and they tend to move in trend movements, and this will have an impact on the exchange rate of the rand against the dollar and the euro. And obviously this plays an important role in our thinking going forward about our own policy stance. Move on to that. Let me just show you this before I conclude. Over quite some time, since January 2011, the exchange rate of the rand has depreciated quite substantially. I've got here the nominal effective exchange rate, which is the blue, and we get to about 31.2% depreciation up to about in August. Then the real effective exchange rate depreciation is about 22%. This is obviously both a good thing and a bad thing. As a good thing, it helps the economy rebalance. It makes households and companies think differently about consuming imports and buying imports, and it also improves competitiveness of exports. But from an inflation point of view, it is a concern. And as the rand weakens, we tend to get more import parity pricing, and some prices in the domestic economy can come up. So you will see in repeated NEC statements that we talk quite a bit about the currency. Let me conclude by just making a few broad points. Obviously, South Africa is part of this emerging market growth slowdown, but we've been affected by a range of idiosyncratic factors which have been quite unhelpful to our growth performance. Spikes, the power outages, the electricity shortages, that sort of thing has impacted over and above what we can expect to see coming from the other emerging markets. Other emerging markets have their own idiosyncratic factors. We're not alone in having them. Domestic confidence and spending have been very weak, and I showed you in the gross fixed capital formation numbers and the household consumption expenditure numbers how that impacts on actual economic outcomes. And obviously, improvement in our growth performance, we want to see a reversal in those trends. South Africa also has a stubbornly high inflation rate. Again, it has improved very, very recently, and we expect it to continue to improve, but it is remaining uncomfortably high at the top end of the target range. Our terms of trade is softening, which means that all things equal, we don't get as much improvement in our current account and our trade balance as we might from exports and imports, and that's reflected in a large current account deficit, which tends all else equal to put pressure on the exchange rate. Going forward, there will continue to be global pressures from normalization, and these will continue to affect the way in which we view the policy stance and outcomes of South African economy. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Luwal, to give us this perspective on the fiscal framework. Although members, the key is not ready yet outside, so we're going to immediately into the questions to make us some time. Honorable George.
Thank you very much, Chair.
The George is 1, 2, 3, and then the DJ 4, 5.
I'm not on the one, she holds a very high position. She's the chair then too.
I apologize. You are the last one, Alderman Jenny. You ask questions, why it's only graph. I refer you to the presentation by Alderman Cuban, Mr. Cuban Nayu, when we listed the Reserve Bank. That presentation goes with this one. You must read the two together. I don't know. It's not going in that order. Please just mention your name for the secretary presenters and to whom you are putting the question.
Thank you, Chairperson. My name is Leon George, member of the Finance Committee. Let me start off with the fiscal, the Financial and Fiscal Commission. Thanks very much for your presentation. It was very interesting. I just want some clarity. You mentioned on the first slide about the economy still feeling the effects of the global economic downturn. Now, of course, we know that, and as we've heard from other presentations, that there is a slow recovery in other economies, but certainly not in ours. You don't mention, or in your presentation, there is a slight mention of some domestic factors, but you don't highlight that as a major issue, I think. So I just want clarity on that. Are you saying that the situation we find ourselves in is, you know, largely or mostly a result of the global downturn, or are there domestic factors that are getting in the way of our recovery? I'd like your opinion on that, please. Then on the Parliamentary Budget Office, thank you very much. I was very impressed with your presentation, and I can see now why the legislation that grows from this committee was necessary, and it's wonderful to see the results of that work. On page, your slides 12 and 13, I think that actually is the crux of the whole issue, where you're talking about these assumptions and risks to our economy and the implications. Now, on the assumptions, you make some assumptions, for example, improved labor environments, improved skills implementation of the NDP, etc., global recovery, electricity supply. How do you determine the probability that your assumptions are going to actually come to pass? And then when you talk about the risks, I said we're not going to that now. Specifically, I want to ask you about your assumption on the labor environment improving. Have you done any work on that? And then on the tax increases that are obviously coming in February, our way, thank you for listening them here. And you did mention briefly about the implications of some of those. Have you done any, or are you planning to do any more work on this? Because it obviously matters immensely what happens to the tax regime. And then to the Reserve Bank, thank you also very, very much for your excellent snapshot of the macroeconomic picture. On page 27, on the final slide, you talk about the idiosyncratic factors that are unhelpful. Now, I know there are several of them. If you could pick one that was the top of the pile, what would it be? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson David Doss, Standing Committee of Finance. With regards to the state-owned entities and public entities, the Parliamentary Budget Office has made some recommendations with regards to transfers. And we saw that the internal saving and expenditure that would be the percentage of about 40%, which is a significant saving in state-owned entities. When we spoke to the minister indicated that these entities will still be fully funded, of course, to ensure that they're still efficient as possible. It's a bit of a contradiction in terms of being such a high percentage in terms of reducing the funding to these entities. But my question also to the minister that was not adequately answered was with regards to the injection of private capital into the state-owned entities. What would the position be and what role can parliamentary budget office play in terms of, or can I rephrase it and rather say, what progress has been made in terms of the shedding off of some of these entities? Exactly what it's been an issue coming for a long, long time to get certain entities and especially ESCOM more efficient. And if we can have some indication as to what the reality is in terms of the current status of injecting private capital to these state-owned entities. Then just with regard to the very good presentation by the Reserve Bank, I just note that in terms of shocks to the mining and manufacturing sector, how large that was, and the contractions in the mining trade, construction and transport, and then also a slight increase in agriculture. The shocks, of course, is in industries where I think should be the main driver of job creation in those areas. And just bringing that into context with the revenue and tax proposals in terms of the different forms of taxation, in terms of corporate taxes and the shortfall in terms of a total of 10 billion, would it not be very negative to consider tax increases on those industries when we have these extremely constrained conditions? Thank you.
Three.
Thank you very much, Chair. Chair, I might have mistranslated because I lost my
until the minister has announced that they're going to capitalize funding for state-owned enterprises. Now, if you look at other countries, state-owned enterprises operate like corporate businesses. They survive on their own. And when you look at ours, like the FAA, for instance, on a regular basis, we tend to intervene, which is a question that at one point we have to decide whether we want to continue doing that or we want to take a different approach altogether. I'm interested to know from Mr. Chavez whether this is in the law. Secondly, we're at 25 days for intention of the report. At one point I asked whether we're not going to be at 100 days once. We need to be warned in advance if moving that direction. If you look at the trade balance, we also lose our market share to the previous countries. If you look at trade balance, for instance, between Africa and China, there's a difference of a very high percentage. The economic size of the BRIC countries does not even come closer to what we have. Now, we should decide whether our fiscal base will relate to tax collections. When in the EU, I know that there's a march against increased taxes as we speak. Or are we going to come with other innovative mechanisms to ensure that we do not only have this burden to the consumer, but to have a balance? So I'd be interested to know what's going to be the approach moving to the next 5 years, because for now, we don't have an option but to increase our taxes.
Although Tobias, your questions are directed at all three stakeholders. You mentioned Treasury in the beginning. Treasury, not yet.
Would be given an economic overview, so I think they I can hear the interest in it.
So you noted all the questions.
It relates to what how our economy looks like. Before?
Thank you, Chairperson, and I'm sorry I didn't look at I was number four. It's because I've never heard the number as a name, you see that. That's why. My name is Bongile Nkomo. I'm a member of the Standing Committee on Finance. I think I've only got two questions. The first one is not really a question, it's a compliment to our Parliamentary Budget Office. I think the issues which have actually captured my mind were actually some of the areas which have been given as matters that are quite important to us, like the minister, for instance, noting the assumptions and the risks, as well as a lot of research around the risk of fiscal outlook. I must state that they've done quite well, and that is to be signed, and the other young man was also addressing the matter. My question specifically goes to a valuable input which I got fully. The first one I did not get fully, but this one is on the South African Reserve Bank input. The matter here which came up and which I've noted and which is a concern is our imports that are coming so large in our country versus the weakening of the rand. I think there's an issue here where the input addressed the matter of stating that with the weak rand, we are getting more imports that are coming to the country. And when one looks at the challenges that we're faced with over the graphs that we're given and everything else, it's quite a serious matter. And I think Honorable Tan also spoke about China and all those good countries, you know, and the seriousness of the matter. I just want to find out, noting the challenges that we're faced with, especially in mining, in manufacturing, and some of the other areas, that once we keep on going with the projections that are coming up as a way of addressing the challenges, how much of that will we be seeing as a reality in South Africa as well as globally? Because yes, it is projections, but one needs to see our economy in the end stabilizing and coming to an economy that would serve the people of South Africa. I think there was the issue of the households, where household graphs was actually going down. It means that our people becoming poorer or they are not being managed properly. So how much of that can we actually incorporate and say to ourselves in the end, things are starting to pick up? I think there was also a graph here lastly which stated that we may not reach the peaks that we used to reach, and that was the gold peaks in the graph. What actually is going to assist? Because as long as those peaks are going down, it means that things are not okay. It's just a need of saying that how do we reassure the country, noting all these areas that are here, which seem to be saying things are just not going okay. Thanks.
So I can't answer that question. You can
answer. Okay, thank you. My apologies, is my name. Thank you very much. First of all, although I did not get to hear your full presentation at the finance subcommission, I certainly agree with your recommendation that we should avoid across the board partially implementing a change to control debt, because I think there is a danger there that you're going to end up, you know, even, you know, punching even though debts are not necessarily supposed to be punched or the innocent ones. My second question, well, that's just a comment, but my question, I really want, I'm more inclined towards the school of thought that says, you know, external factors, we don't have much control over. But internal factors, we do have the control over those. And I would love to hear maybe the South African Reserve Bank to assist us, maybe unpack a lot more your last slide, your kind of and through it, and we're beginning to speak to these factors. Probably assist us with the hierarchy of risk that we have from the South African Reserve point of view. Because I feel that maybe if we don't really get to understand some of the domestic challenges that we have, we may end up, you know, just gloating over and keep on blaming the global crunch and so forth, which is okay, fine, it's there, let's face it. But the reality is, we can't deal with what we can control, let's deal with what we can change. We have the power to change our own domestic thing if there is political will to do so. You know, so that would be one. But the other one that I wanted to get from the budget office, I just wanted to share with you. You know, there is something that in this country we have not really done. And I am speaking as a former local government practitioner. You know, if you look at if we are talking about wage bill, I'm very, very uncomfortable with us putting local government, provincial government, and national government together when you are talking about wage bill. Because if you are really, and probably you need to explain to us, okay, out of the 2.3 million How many of those, that's a big number, fairly specific, how many of those are in the national and provincial government? Because that's how we're going to address the litigation. And in my own experience in local government, at some point when our CEO saga, we were employing only just about all the municipalities combined. And remember, the municipalities are doing everything. We're only about 270,000. And your national and provincial government were employing the bulk of the people, and most of them just paper pushers. And to me, I think really we are not beginning to address the issues of productivity in this country. We are paying people exorbitant salaries just to authorize somebody. You know? And I think maybe you need to assist us by breaking down what exactly do we mean when we are saying 2.3 million in these 3 years of government. And again, I also want you to justify your 9% in local government. I'm not a substitute of local government. But I'm merely saying to you, there is something that we are not really focusing on in this country. Because when I think I did raise this thing with the minister about whether National Treasury has actually done a study in minute detail of where are the leadership. Because I know that some provincial governments, they are advertising and marketing budget is exorbitant. And those are some of the areas that we need to start focusing on. And coming to the issue of the possibility, and I'm raising this, I'm very cautious when I'm raising this matter, of how we are going to be raising the 27 billion, the revenue that we'll be talking about. You know, I stand to be corrected here. Your personal income tax is already accounting for your major share. I can't remember what his percentage is, but it's your main share of your our nation.
Can you wrap up my question, please?
Okay, perfect. Can I just stop there? Let's get other people at chat. That's fine.
Number 6, 7, 8, 9. You are the last one.
Okay.
You want to be?
Thank you, Chair. My name is Nikiti Kam, member of the COF. Chair, I think I want to just raise two or three things, which, and I would agree with what Honorable Makosi has said on one or two issues around the Reserve Bank and the 9% cut around local government. You know, this, the report from the FSC is very interesting. And I think I would want us to follow through as and when we do our in-year monitoring. And also, just juxtapose that with what the PBO has done, which is also a very good work that will empower us as a committee to develop a framework that will assist us to follow through on some of the things that the PBO has raised very sharply in terms of following up on issues of SOEs and DFIs, but also the 3 years in line with what the MPPP is saying. But Chair, if you look at page 8, which is to me very critical and fundamental for the FSC to look at, the slides that the FSC has spoken to. The slide just above, which speaks about dollar for provincials here, and the slide that talks about dollar for locals here. I think, Chair, the time is now for us to really go back to the framework and the what is this thing? How you the formula for division of revenue and start to zoom into the critical areas around it. You're saying it very explicitly, as I see that the focus in provinces has been more on education and other things. We are underlooking the economic potential of provinces in as far as division of revenue is concerned. And we'll give you, I mean, examples like the Northwest, how Eastern Cape is now moving into, Cape Town is now expanding around some of the areas, Limpopo as well, the areas. And these are your predominantly rural provinces. And they have economic potential, but the division of revenue on economic development around those provinces is something else. And this is the area where we have to look into. Now, looking at DORA and probably putting forward a municipal like Nelson Mandela Bay, your PE, where we want some industrial electricity, expansion of industrial electricity around there, looking at Limpopo, the municipality called Lephalale as an example, and look at the kind of money and investment that goes in today, but how the cuts that are being proposed may also bring unintended consequences. So I'm saying, you're raising very sharp issues that begins to make us engage on some of the things that will assist us to unlock the economic potentials of these provinces. And that's why I fully agree with Honorable Makosi when she says, there are domestic things that we have or that we can lay our hands on and change. What are those? And let's begin to engage with them. So it will be interesting for us to start to check on what you are saying, but also your role at the NHC in influencing some of these things and guiding the process so that going forward there's a change in some of these things. Thank you, Chair.
The NHC meets on a regular basis with the provinces at the provincial legislators, but it's very important that those meetings and the executives also attend those meetings. That's just a message. That's been clearly. Okay.
Oh, well, thank you very much, Chair. And I don't know what number I am. Well,
just a quick request. Just be short with your questions, please. To the point.
Oh, okay. Hey, is it because the opposition is asking questions? No, sir.
I'm with you. No, sir, that's not the point. The point is be to the point of your question.
Now, I'm calling your lecture.
Please, thank you.
No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding, Chair. No need to be upset. I'm going to repeat a question I asked the Minister last time around. It wasn't answered. And the question is directed to the Department of Sussex. And in particular, it's about, if you look at the general norm where the wage settlements, especially in the public sector, about your inflation rates. Wouldn't you say that if we continue on that path, then you might end up letting the effectiveness of inflation targeting monetary policy as an instrument to anchor people's inflation expectations? Because it's been continuing for a while, and to a certain extent, there's a thing, each and every now and then, the admissions is targeted for a number of reasons, obviously, not because of this reason alone. The other very important question which I wish to ask to the budget office, if you look at slide number 6, an issue which was raised by Honorable George earlier on, but I want to weigh in that question and say, when you talk about the improvement as an assumption in the labor environment, what assumption are you basing that? More importantly, are you considering what maybe the FFC said in their presentation that a multi-year agreement might be able to improve labor relations in South Africa, because that seems to be a problem, a recurring problem, I should say. Thank you very much.
Right.
Thanks, Chair. I gave you a proposition, it was number 7. Let me ask this one. Most of the questions that I had were covered by the two ecclesiasticals, the two masters in France here. They actually covered most of what I was supposed to ask.
Yeah.
But I still have at least a few here. Mine is just about the FSC. I just wanted to know what role do they play when you know, the executive power takes decisions. I just want to refer to this recent one by the president, this new reaction. I just want to know if maybe is there any coordination of some kind, maybe with the office of the presidency or maybe the executive power in its entirety. Because seemingly when this was announced, everybody was just shocked, and I'm still, you know, living in that shock today. I just want to know if they are playing any major role when major decisions of this nature are taken or are pursued. Number two, I say this because most of the committees, I say this most of the time, we seem to be rather saving most of the decisions taken by the executive power. So let me know if maybe there are some decisions that we can play part as parliamentary committees, or we have sometimes adjust things to most of the decisions that are taken by the executive power. Maybe before I pause, let me ask about the inconsistent budget by Gautrain. This has been the worrying factor for most of the time. As you may know that now...
Mr. McNeely, sorry to interrupt you. That question is actually for tomorrow's meeting on appropriations. Tomorrow we are dealing jointly with the Standing Committee of Appropriations with that part of the MTPBS.
But I think that this one they can answer because I don't think it's relevant yet. Let me ask it today. Because I think this is the right platform.
I'm going to respond it tomorrow, not today.
It's okay.
Yes.
The inconsistent budget by, this house, I understand the public tax is rejecting about 8 million on a month to month. I just want to know why is there no consistent budget? Just to mention that, this how train runs mostly. Because as of now, we learned it from reliable sources that the public were injecting about 80 million. And on the month to month, of course. And maybe before, I also want to know that, This thing also extends to SAA. SAA, let in and year out, they run out of budget. And we will give them a facelift of some kind. Again, on a year to year. This is a serious concern of some kind. Because we just want to know if there is an effective budget, which is given to these parastatals. Because, there's a lot of them. They run out of budget before the year comes to an end. ESCOM, SAA, SABC, and now recently we have the South African Post Office, which has about 21 video, which just vanished into thin air. And all these things to account that is what is actually happening. So we want them to at least come out clear and open to say, we know this is what actually happened, surrounding the Post Office issue. Because sometimes the powers that be might have had a hand on that 21 million. So this I think should be set here so that all of us should know about it. Thank you,
Chair.
Thank you very much. I think my colleagues was said earlier on. I missed the FSC presentation, but I have been following on the slides distributed. I just wanted to make to reinforce the issue of sustainability that was posed on the state-owned entities. I wonder if there is a specific advice, or maybe a recommendation from the presenters on how do we ensure that we have a sustainable state-owned enterprises. It might be based on the global experiences because this is something that has been going on in other countries, or maybe it might be based on our unique local circumstances. I would appreciate if we get some clear indication over and above what has been recommended in the MTBS from the presenters as to what is their suggestion as we deal with this issue of state-owned enterprises. And then secondly, currently in the public disposal, one of the suggestions that is dominant is that as we advocate for the trading of expenditure, or maybe the change of our spending pattern from consumption to investment, there might be other sectors within the government that are doing the otherwise. In fact, there is a cartoon in the television stage yesterday where they are showing a minister trying to slow down and the presidency accelerate. That's in suggesting that there is an issue here around compliance on some of the key undertakings, as much as they are commendable. Now, I want to hear the view of the presenters on that particular perception, but also check if in their take the prevailing mechanisms, compliance mechanisms, are adequate to ensure that all the government departments are able to comply with these undertakings that are made from time to time. And then the third feature, which might be my last question, on the sale of non-strategic assets, I mean to deal with issues of deficit, as well as to deal with issues of obviously sustaining some of these state of funding, some of the state-owned enterprises. Let's get to know what are the principles, because we need to be collective. I mean, there is an indication here that we must wait, or some of the presenters are waiting to hear on exactly what that is, state-owned enterprises that are going to be sold. What are the principles, if you are to advise, what are the principles that need to be adhered to as we undertake this key exercise? I think that will help, because I'm one of those who are arguing that this is a crime suicide. I mean, there might be some unintended ramifications if we are not cautious on how we deal with this matter. Because I'm based my submission on the experience that is in abundance about how some of these interventions have affected, I mean, our development agenda. And just as a comment, I've seen the LSC presentation very specific about some of the recommendations that they are supporting and some of the recommendations that are generating. And I missed that from the analysis of the budget office as well as the respect, because they just give an analysis and the opinion on that analysis, but I think they're ready on what are the specific recommendations that we need to look at. And I think for me that's very much important. And I think ever since committees, at that stage we need to just take an exercise of reviewing how far are some of these recommendations made really adhered to. I will cite an example, it's an interesting one on issues of funding, is the renewal of the provincial funding mechanism. And I am not sure the reviewer of provincial funding mechanism. I'm not sure how far we moved to make sure that particular recommendation is subjective, because I've never had any opposition to the said recommendation, or especially as obviously advocated by the LSC. I think at a stage as committees, we really need to check on some of the recommendations that are tabled by these several institutions and those that we agree with. Let's check, let us assess to what extent are we moving in terms of implementation that they are implemented. Thank you.
Okay.
Some of these issues can be addressed here, needless to say. But the first thing that occurs to me is we've only got three, Peter Paul and others here, only three submissions for the hearings. And if you look at the entities before us, I mean, it's the PBO, the FHC, and the Reserve Bank. We're the voice of civil society. Now, as I understood it, we used to have public hearings, and we still do, after the budget is presented in February. My recollection for many years, I mean, Comrade Tucky might remember, this venue was full. And then they came to speak with constructive and civil society organizations and said, look, what is the point of us making submissions? Because we can't change the budget. We ain't coming. And some of the civil society organizations have started to retreat. Now we get the Money Bills Amendment Act passed. Now we provide for public hearings. In fact, 3 months before the budget, it's easier maybe to shape the budget by participating in public hearings now. Maybe I'm wrong, but my sense is that it would be to participate in public hearings in late February. So one of the things maybe our two committees need to look at, I don't think now, is in what way has the Money Bill Act facilitated public participation? That's the first thing that strikes me. The second thing that occurs to me is in public hearings, and this is one of the things I think Jesus is trying to say, or he said, in public hearings, we're meant to hear what the entities, especially entities here, are saying concretely, deep cultural recommendations. What we've got instead, with the greatest of respect, it helps me because I'm not technically competent enough, and I'm growing my understanding, so it helps me as a learner, but not as a chair of the committee. I'm learning more about the economy. But what I don't know as a politician is, what are you experts saying? Maybe the FHC is restrained, and the Reserve Bank is restrained. I'm not sure about the role of PBO, but what are you saying can be done? What are your concrete recommendations? For the most part, there's a lot of overlap. All of you seem to see the economic problem in a very similar way. All of you seem to be probably supporting, substantially supporting the MTPPS. Then the question becomes, how, what do you think we can do with mitigating this? And, you know, what is it, this and what do you have? I think you have assumptions. So what can we do to make assumptions implemented? And what can we do to mitigate the risk? Mitigate the right word, I think, it's like reduce the prospect of the risk happening. So the other thing I wanted to ask you is, national strategy insists it's not an austerity budget. What is your take on that? Maybe not your constraint from saying it because it falls outside your mandate. Then I wanted to ask some specific questions, and I don't know that you're going to have the time to deal with this, but you see, some of the questions we raised are raised because they are themes that this, our committee, Standing Committee on Finance, and I'm sure much the way that your committee also preoccupied. There's some issues that we want over time to find answers to, not keep asking. So, incrementally moving towards answers to these questions. For example, take the FFP, talk about normal interest rates. What do you mean by normal interest rates? What is normal? Is it normal specific to developmental tasks of a country and so on? Then you talk about, I don't understand this term, but maybe you can talk outside this committee with me, or maybe you can help me say, what's the specific excise duty on Table 21? Unallocated resources, you're unhappy about it, right? Maybe you want to say something there about, is there, given the size of our budget and our socioeconomic goals, a minimum you think should be unallocated resource? Then you talk about productivity being increased. Well, yes, but what you are proposing the rebuttal in the telephone FSC, you don't have a specific expertise to do so, but how do we improve labor productivity? Maybe it's outside the terrain, but I don't know if you mentioned it. Then you say move more towards NDP and the medium term strategic framework in slide 27. How is that going to be done? What are your proposals in that regard? Slide 15 of PBO. I've got to skip that, I'm running out of time. I think I want to ask the same questions as to some extent as still. Those assumptions that you make, firstly, on what are they based? And secondly, what would be the consequences of them not being realized? And thirdly, how can we realize them if you have any proposals in that regard at all? Now, look, it's not fair. Too many questions to them. But you pick up on the main ones, and then those who take notes for now. I think our committee by the end of this year, we have a list of questions that we've been asking repeatedly. We send it to the entities concerned, and then we move forward from there. It's a question we need as older members of parliament to ask about the nature and format of public hearings. See, Comrade, I'm lobbying you. But the thing is, we ask hundreds of questions, they reply quickly, and then sometimes they write back to us. The next year comes, and we ask the same questions again in a different form. We need to move forward. We need to review how we do public hearings. And it strikes me today, jarring, because look what we've got here, compared to what we should have, given the Money Bills Act, and given the potential. And finally, I want to say something else that's quite striking. Given the severe constraints of the economy, given litigations on productions and expenses, maybe the words, the ministers love these terms, like, we are not going to balance what the books on the backs of the poor. Wonderful. Right? You see, wonderful terms. The real issue is, now what? As parliamentary committees, we have to have a program to monitor and hold the ministers to account and the cabinet to account to it. We need a program. Because see, I cannot understand, I think there's an implicit suggestion in some of the questions asked here. On the state-owned entity, somebody put a question, yeah, by our colleagues here, public colleagues here. No, I mean here, not the two of them. Look, I cannot, I don't care what party a person comes from. If they ask me a rational question,
Order.
I don't care that I belong to one extreme of the ideological spectrum, and the person concerned belongs to the other extreme of the ideological spectrum. I'm listening to my friend from the EFF. But anyway, the fact is, the members are asking, one or two of them are right. You see this thing, that's black-headedability, the state's own taste. This idea that, look at them, many of them are sincerely challenged. And the Treasury said, you know what we're going to do? We're going to actually sell off non-core stocks. Can you imagine? If you try to sell off non-core assets, whatever that might mean, right? The union movement, civil society, sections of the Communist Party, sections of the ANC even will be opposed to that, right? Then by the time you go through all of that, sorry? No, I'm asking a question. It's my job to ask a question. I see this.
It's a good chair.
Let me just pick up a chair, but you see, I write to jive at me because I do that every now and then to them, so I'm fair game. I have no problems. In our community, they heckle me. Forget the opposition, the ANC, the second. I don't mind. So the fact is, one grows by learning, right? The point I want to make is, then the minister says, and I read, if I was in that position, I'd be saying the same thing. So it has nothing to do with the current minister. It's to do with the challenges we have. Now, you think about it. When the money comes in, which year will that be? And what will happen to the state-owned entity in the meanwhile? So what I'm saying is, we need ideas from you. If you go by what Treasury is saying, as somebody says, it's a long haul to find the money, what can we do in the meanwhile to make these state-owned entities function more effectively? The Treasury suggests a very good thing, and you suggest one of you. You can put in the commercial from the development. I was here a public enterprise for my sins for 2.5 years. So I have some insight then. Many of the same issues we're looking at then, I neglected talking at this time. I noticed your hand moving the way it does. Remember, I'm a co-chair. The fact is, colleagues, that thing, we need some more discussion around. And in our report to Parliament, if the majority agree, let me stress, if the majority agree, we need something to be said about the feasibility and practicability of what Treasury says. Right?
Very important inputs made by co-chair Karim. The fiscal framework, the revised fiscal framework we are dealing with now, is the roadmap for the budget of 2015-16. That's how important this session is. Now, there are advertisements for this public hearing. It was in all the leading newspapers. It was even on the radio, even on regional radio. So I listen a lot of radio because I'm driving on the N7 to my constituency. So the opportunity is there for society, for organized business, etc., to come and make the inputs. The doors of Parliament are open. So that is an open invitation. Thank you for your questions, honourable members. You may reply in the way you did your presentations. You want tea? It's a quick coffee break. We are all human. Thank you. We're back within 10 minutes, please. Thank you. 10 minutes.
after 8:15 on this.
Okay, we'll be in front.
I'm all right, just shout.
Thank you, honourable members, for your cooperation. Let's proceed. And we will call on the FFC Committee Budget Office and the Reserve Bank to reply to the questions. Thank you.
Thank you, honourable chair. Thank you, honourable members. We'll respond to the questions between myself and Dr. Ramos Mapopo next to me here. I think let me start with Dr. George's question. I think you are right that in terms of what is in the PowerPoint presentation, we don't actually get into the details of the gravity of the challenge now, which is only, I think we can mention that there are two challenges, the external issues, and then there is now the domestic challenges that we need to deal with. And I think it's important that in terms of our own assessment, the weight of the domestic challenge is actually becoming more important or more significant than the external environment. Because if you look at our assessment, the work that we've been doing with respect to the economic outlook and the fiscal framework since the onset of the depression, you will find that what we refer to now, what we're talking about, is the pessimistic scenario that we painted back in 2011 when we said if the
recovery, the global economic recovery is slow, then the South African recovery will probably take until around about 2015 and beyond. And even then, it's not going to get to the previous levels where the economy was performing before the crisis. So that was purely looking at the external factors. Now, what has since happened is that the domestic factors have become even more critical because the South African economy has structural challenges that need to be addressed. There are also non-structural challenges that have emerged also to be equally important. And I think if one were to look at the structural challenges, you'd probably be looking at the outcomes of your education and health sectors. You'll be looking at issues around the energy shortages and transportation infrastructure. So you've got all of these bottlenecks that basically present significant challenges to South African economy. On the non-structural side, you also have your labor issues, pressures, some of which the position tried to disentangle, even though economists would probably have different views in terms of the importance of each of those factors. So your current account deficits, your consumer spending constraints, and all of those types of issues will actually have an impact. And these, I think, what is most important is that the internal discussions and need for a united front in terms of tackling the internal challenges, a foundation is there built around the National Development Plan, which has actually identified some of these issues that I'm raising as key areas that need attention. So maybe there is a need to actually then focus on those and see what it is that actually can be done from a united front, and I think institutions like MetLife become quite important in some of these discussions around how we resolve some of these issues. So I think in terms of the question that you asked of us, Dr. George, that would be our view. So we are in no way underestimating the impacts of the issues that you raised. Honorable Ross did not direct any question to us, unless Dr. Obubu would like to discuss some of the issues. I think we've discussed some of the issues that you raised before. Honorable Tobias basically raised quite a number of general sort of questions, and they related to, as far as we would want to respond, they relate to the SOEs, and I'm going to delegate that response to Dr. Mabuk to respond when it was the issue around the state-owned companies. Honorable Koza, I think the questions that you have raised are quite critical, and I think the issue of the external versus the internal sectors, I just highlighted some of the challenges that are very direct, that are within the control of government. And not only should one be looking at government to resolve this, but the various structures and institutions, whether they're in the private sector or in the public sector, that are actually established to represent. I think it's important what the Honorable Co-Chair, Honorable Karim, is raising around what are the solutions, because if you lay down a story like the medium-term budget policy statement, the idea is for people to actually engage with it and present concrete comments around it and ideas around it that would empower Parliament as the institution that must engage with the executive on this document ultimately through this money bills amendment procedure and related matters like that. It would be I think it would be overestimating the capacity of the state to assume that the institution like the Financial and Fiscal Commission will have all the answers. We have identified what we think are some of the key issues that need to be addressed, where we can make recommendations, and invariably, as I said in my opening remark, most of the recommendations that we made in May when we tabled the transition seem to be resonating with what are the key things that I mentioned in this MTBS. So the
discussions that we've been having with the provinces as well, because we have these discussions with the provinces in terms of where we think Parliament must actually be looking at. And so I think those internal challenges that are there, we have actually discussed them. So maybe at this particular point in time, it's up to Parliament to say, what you have said here at the FSC, this is how we're going to deal with it. But here we need you to actually provide us with more information around how we engage with government. And that's taking the conversation to the level that Honorable Karim, you're probably looking at, because it's the things that we must look at now. But these are moving targets. It's evolving, and so we should be looking at it like that.
Mr. Kumalo, I noted all the advice.
Chair, I need to make this point. Basically, it's on the response that we get from the FSC. And actually, it relates to the profound issues that Honorable Karim has raised. You see, if we say that the economy is facing structural changes, and structural challenges, it means we need to act. But what we're not saying in this meeting is that there is a policy difference between what is the government outlook in terms of what we need to implement and other societal structures in terms of what they think should be the intervention in the economy. And NSLEC does not necessarily play an adequate role to change this fundamental difference that has been made, because this issue is not new. And the chair made it very clear. Advertisement has been taken out to invite people to public hearings for engagement. But in my opinion, it's not adequate. We need to have the view of the FSC or a role that is being played to change the mindset in terms of how we as society and government look at the policy mechanisms that we need to implement. Because I'm saying this, that if labor play a particular role that seems to be negative, how do we change that? Who's supposed to engage beyond the NGO, which is African National Congress, taking a policy decision that needs to be implemented by government, but when we go to NSLEC, we differ. Those are the fundamental issues. They are not about rents and cents. It's about the decisions that we take to change the current outlook. And to me, the SSC remains a very critical player, because there is an independent body that overlooks that. It should be able to make specific recommendations. I'm saying this because the other day we had a frank engagement with the governor of the Reserve Bank. She was very frank about what she thought was the best way of dealing with certain challenges. And she engaged us as politicians to say the type of policy positions you hold at some point does not affect the economy. So we should not really dilly about how to answer that fundamental question that you raised, so that when we come at the next fiscal year, we got clear resolutions as to how are we going to address, especially what Makosi termed as local matters that we cannot be able to address. Those are external factors. How the mining sector performs, for instance, as an example. The high wage bill that is not sustainable. The unskilled labor force that we have in the current conjuncture, which actually means productivity. And those are the fundamental issues, they're not general issues. Those are actually the gist of the matter in terms of the economic performance if you look at internal factors. So if we apportion responsibility to say you politicians meet in the corner in NSLEC, we as experts we just tell you that there is this challenge and then you see how we deal with that and don't facilitate an engagement. So maybe we should use a different approach from how we engage. Fill up and maybe invite people individually and say, can you come and explain to us what you think is going to be sustainable in the economy and engage? And I think maybe we should create that first meeting in Parliament.
The people that usually comes to the hearings, including Kusan, including including the other unions. They said they're coming in February, when the main budget is tabled. Because when I saw the list, I said, but there's only three institutions, entities. They can't come. So that was a reply. A report will be compiled on the revised fiscal framework and dealt with on Thursday after books by the joint committees. And then these recommendations can be captured in that report. You may continue, Mr. Kamalo.
Okay, thank you, Chair. The other matter that Honorable Khoza raised is the issue around the wage bill and the need to disentangle and not aggregate between 3 years of government. I think it's very much agreed, and from our side as coalition, because this is the way on the wage bill we started probably about 2-3 years ago when we started raising this as a matter in terms of the composition of government spend. It was indeed a concern. Now we then, together with the Public Service Commission, have started a joint exercise where we are actually looking at how we then link the wage bill across the board to the productivity. So one can actually go through the three different spheres and looking at them differently in terms of what the delivery or constitutional mandate for each sphere of government is and where are the people who actually drive that wage bill sitting. I think one of the key issues that has come to the fore is that in some instances there is too many administrators relative to the front desk type of people, and obviously one has to look at that. There's even been discussions in terms of the work that we are doing that look at the possibility of even prescribing what norms should actually apply. But those are options that we are actually going to be looking at, and obviously one has to respect the independence of the 3 spheres of government and then also the interdependence of the 3 spheres of government and the responsibility. So one has to look at it in a holistic manner, so that we can get to some understanding that we obtain value from the wage bill. And in most cases, people make the mistake of talking about wage bill as if they are talking about salaries. That's a different set of issues that is on the table. So it's not about salaries, but it's about the bill and the value that you are actually generating from that. Then Honorable Bekana, you have also raised the issue around the provincial fiscal framework. I think maybe just to say that when we look at the responses that has to happen when the global economic crisis set in by the 3 years of government, what you see is that the least affected sphere of government in terms of responses that had or measures that had to be taken in order to deal with that, the least affected sphere of government is actually the provincial government sphere. And it's very easy to understand why. It's because we manage expenditures in the provinces. We don't actually, that's a very cynical way of putting it, but it's really about managing expenditures, and I think the discussion now has to be about what role can provinces play. Now, in terms of the assignment of functions, I mean, there's quite a significant responsibility placed in terms of economic development within the provinces that provinces can play. And as you say, Honorable Picano, some provinces have done far much more than other provinces. And I think in terms with some provinces, you can see, for example, how the discussion has actually shifted to how do we actually move our team to a different level of economic development driven by the people of our team. And I think maybe there's a story to be learned out of the e-tolling story, because it begins to say to people who live here,
you have these services, and how do you then manage to pay for them? Because that's what must be happening. And so that conversation, it has its own other dimensions to it. But it also speaks to what the role of provinces is with respect to provincial economic development issues, for lack of a better word. And I think the fiscal framework for provinces has maybe by default developed in such a way that people almost like believe that it's about expenditures rather than, and also even limiting it to the three big functions that provinces are responsible for, which basically does not give a true picture of what provinces should be doing. So that is why we are raising this as a matter that needs to be looked at, but I think we'll pick it up again in tomorrow's discussion. It's probably more relevant there. Honorable, there is a lot of questions that you raise that unfortunately maybe I need to repeat what the role of the Commission is with respect to some of these issues. The role of the Commission is to actually make recommendations to Parliament. I'll say that in this particular case on the financial and fiscal matters. Now, your questions are about our role when executive decisions are taken. I would say that we probably have no role, except that we must be consulted when certain decisions are taken that have or have financial and fiscal implications. We can also, on our own, decide that, no, look, this, we have this financial and fiscal. If they tie in with what we consider to be our mandate, then we will actually make a submission. But that submission will be made to Parliament primarily. Now, in terms of the questions that you have raised, specifically the nuclear measure, I must say that what I know about it is what I've raised in the paper. So I have absolutely no knowledge of what is actually happening except what the typical man in the street knows about it. Now, if Parliament, on the other hand, looks at it and decides that, no, we want the FFC providers to its views on this particular matter, because this is how it has been designed, and so then we will be able to come in and say, no, this is our views about it. So otherwise, at this point in time, I can't actually say anything. Now, when it comes to issues of the budget process, the FFC is unlikely to be a rubber stamping institution, because the FFC must table its recommendations 10 months before the minister tables the budget. So we tables our recommendations for 2015 in May. And so your engagement with this medium term as a policy statement must be with reference to the recommendations that we tables to you in May. And so if we have not actually had the opportunity to see those recommendations, it will probably be difficult for you to understand our view on this medium-term budget policy statement, because our view is that this medium-term budget policy statement is in line with the key things that we thought needed to be the drivers for the 2015 budget and the LTEF. So we identified key issues that we thought needed to be taken into consideration, and I've listed some of them in the slides that we presented today, that you can then link to what is in the LTVPS, and then you can say, so if on the other hand there was no such a link, then we would probably say something different today about there are certain things that we raise, saying we might agree with this type of an approach, but we're saying you need to be cautious with how you then approach or implement such a step. So for example, with respect to expenditure ceilings, just say let's impose expenditure ceilings just across the board on everything. So you can actually balance these things and say these programs are performing okay, so we can actually grow them faster than this, so that these trade-offs are actually happening within that. So but the principles, if they are the same, would be, it might appear that same, but I really think that we did independent work which we tabled in May, and so it's not about rubber stamping decisions made by the executives. Now the issue around the Gautrain And also, I think you were referring to the, I would assume you were referring to bailouts to FAA. I think our position on these types of interventions at the national level is very clear. I mean, we have dealt with these issues since the days of the first guarantee that was given to ESCOM, which was like 60 billion. I think it's probably more than 8 years ago now. We have raised these issues that there has to be a way in which the contingent liabilities to states that are linked to those guarantees will be managed. So if the state believes that the books are in such a way that going forward, these institutions will be able to actually stand on their own, there is absolutely no problem. But if you see yourself able to do this on an annual basis, then there must be something that needs to be done outside of just providing some of these guarantees. And so, in terms of my response to you on those particular matters, I would say that our submissions over the past 2-3 years basically speak to that. But we are actually working on some work, doing some work around these state-owned companies, and some of the issues that were raised by the Minister of Finance, which he indicated that details will be provided going forward. We have, at a conceptual level, we have some documents that we have put together that I think we can be able to actually share with the committee. I mean, this preliminary work, I mean, we don't want to speculate on some of these things and probably give the wrong message in terms of what, from our perspectives as a commission, the future of the state-owned companies must look like. So we have some work that we can share around that. But I think Dr. Mabugu will say a little bit more than I have said. Honorable Van Rooyen, so that must cover your question on the SOEs. The issues around the cost containment measures called compliance, whether when we have a legal tender policy statement like this and everybody is being encouraged to look at the environment and take the necessary measures. I actually think that there is actually substantive compliance amazingly. I mean, my involvement, and I think the chairperson, two co-chairpersons who agree with me, in the Budget Council where some of these issues have been discussed around compliance with cost containment measures, it does show that there is some positive movement or responses that across all spheres in terms of responding to these proposals on cost containment. Obviously, the full impact one can look at one, because this started in December last year. So we have to look at it like at the end of the financial year, what it will look like. But certainly, one has seen quite substantial improvement in some of the areas that have been targeted, especially on travel and on catering and conferencing and all of those types. They look small things, but there's quite some significant movement. I would also say that from Commission's point of view, what we have said was that we need these cost containment measures sometimes as prescriptions, we should not overly prescribe, because we need to also leave room for innovation within the different departments or within the service. Because once you overly prescribe, then people tend to do it to comply. So they're not going to go beyond what's actually prescribed. So you just need to be very careful on how you deal with this. I know that it sounds like making things complicated, but it does complicate innovation at an accounting level when things are prescribed. On the sale of non-strategic assets, and I think Honorable Van Rooyen, that's an area that in our concept document that I say we've been working on. And we were requested by the previous Minister of Finance to actually just look at some of these issues, so we are at that point. So there are certain principles that we have identified that must actually be adhered to, that we must, yeah. Then obviously the final set of questions that Honorable Karim has raised, maybe from the Commission's perspective, the one that I must respond to is it an austerity budget? These are terms, these are very technical terms that are actually used. What we know is that when you refer to austerity, you actually mean that you have cut spending. So instead of your expenditure growing, your expenditure is actually being cut. Now, here what is happening is you are slowing down the growth rate in public spending. So from a technical position, you probably not yet reached austerity, but you are moving in that direction. You don't reach that point technically yet, but you are definitely slowing down growth in public spending. And maybe, importantly so, the issue around how do we then avoid getting to the point where we must cut public spending if we don't want to continue accumulating this debt, then it brings the issue of the tax review and whether we can support that from the tax review side. Now, balancing this or not doing this on the backs of the poor, yeah, that I think is a difficult one, but it's really about what do you do to the revenue handles that you have if you are actually going to try and close that gap without necessarily hurting the poor. So you will have to be very selective on the tax instrument that you target. Now, we have absolutely no idea what the Davis Tax Commission has been doing. Even though one of my former colleagues in the commission is a member of that committee, she never shared anything with us. We are very much awaiting to hear what the preliminary reports basically speak to. And maybe we'll be able to talk about the meaning of not doing all of these things on the back of the poor. Ramos, can I just write first? Because,
I don't think we're going to bias. We must just check our time on the members. There are other meetings running 1 o'clock where I have to be. So, and the other entities must not reply.
Yeah, I won't be long. The CEO is a very diplomatic person, you know. He chooses his words very carefully. But there's one thing that I thought you would recommend outright, to say that the work that you are doing, you'll bring it here, we'll sit together with yourselves and the National Treasury and look at it so that you can agree. If there's a point of disagreement, we can be able to know where to be. So that your view, because we're a very important role to play, the recommendations that we must consider, some of them might be relevant to assist us in solving these challenges. And you know, you become nice, and you can just very safely and so on. That issue, which you are also denied on, it's the whole thing of wanting to have a ceiling. It's an interesting phenomenon, really, and we must engage it. Yeah. So I suggest in the recommendations, Chair, that this matter must be brought here for discussion. That's all that I was supposed to share with all the, with due regards for time and all the things.
All members will have the opportunity to engage with that report before it goes to the House. That's why we're meeting on Thursday, I think, 12:30. Dr. Ramos?
Okay, I'll be very quick and focus on Honorable Karim's last set of questions because they also touched on what other honorable members were raising. Now, the issue of austerity has been addressed. The second definitional issue that she required clarity on was what we mean by normal interest rate. And this is referring to the environment that we gotten used to on the aftermath of the global financial crisis, which was a low interest rate environment. That is unprecedented for a very long time. And what we are saying is that that normal environment can no longer be taken for granted going forward. So it's normal relative to the global crisis where we saw unprecedented low interest rates. Then you raise issues around what is unallocated reserves. These are essential contingent reserves. For the unallocated, we don't have a norm on contingent reserves. Our recommendation is that that portion should not be raised in times, particularly in times that we are going towards. So when we see 45 billion at the end of the MTF, we think it's going in the right direction. If and then it's to be building up of buffers to be able to respond when another crisis comes upon. The excise duty is simply a specific indirect tax on domestically produced goods, particularly or alcohol related commodities of tobacco products and other taxes. Those are the excise duties that we are referring to. Then around labor productivity, we are currently working with the Public Service Commission to really get a full handle on that issue. But we think the foundation of productivity should be getting basic education, right? Which is why we are in agreement with the focus on top priority continuing to be basic education. Because whatever you do at the other end of productivity is influenced by the outcomes that we get around basic education scheme. Now, the last set of issues is the big one in the room that's around state-owned enterprises. And what sort of issues can we take on board now rather than medium-term, long-term issues? I think from what we've been saying over the years, there are three issues for the very immediate term around the issues that have come on the table. The first one is that for a long time now, this issue has been brought back onto the domain for discussion. It's not a completely new issue, as well you school me on that. It is not a new issue, but it has been taken out of the domain for discussion. But now, back because of the medium to budget policy statement, so we can interact around that issue. So that's the first observation, that all of a sudden, this issue is now back on the domain for discussion. The second one is around clarity on tariffs that are allowed going forward. If we take a loan, for example, writing short-term debt issue is interrogating what never allows for the tariffs for ESCOM going forward. And so those are pretty much short-term direct issues to be grappling with. Now I think NESA has moved from allowing 8.5% tariff increase to 12.2% increase. And 18 months ago, argued that we're using economic modeling that even at 12.2% that may be insufficient to get ESCOM on a sustainable path going forward. Although they move to 12.2% is along the right area. So that's the second immediate issue around state-owned enterprises that can be on the table. And the third one, an immediate issue, is when you allow cost-selective tariffs, because that's the essence of the issue around tariffs. When you allow cost-selective tariffs, there are issues on what happens on the social side of it. What are the social ramifications of moving towards cost-effective tariffs where you are moving for a place where you were necessarily saying on the social side, yet a clear entanglement of social issues for talent, the pricing of ladies. So if you tackle social issues and help them deal with what we refer to in the previous presentation, an integrated social package, which is effective and efficient, but not a part of the tariff aspect. So that's the second immediate type issue. How do you address a social problem could be associated with a move towards cost-effective tariffs, could be associated with other aspects that impact on a social outcome. But we are calling for an integrated, quite distinct social package that fits salary to social wage as a general package. Then the final, fourth, very direct aspect around the service is that there are instances where private sector financing can be drawn into financing state activities. Maybe an unfortunate example is the Captain Freeway financed by ITOS, and we're on record as having pronounced on ITOS right before the disturbances that we're currently seeing around us. But there are opportunities for private sector involvement in there, and it's not very different from it's not deviating a lot from government policy on the role that private sector can play in farm set supply initiatives. One can also think of in ECO, the context of independent crop producers, which is actually a part of policy. That's delineating a distinct area for the private sector to have a part of the financing component of the budget that we are talking about. Then you can attempt that to Transnet and the rolling stock. We're talking of very big amounts of more than 150 billion. And there are ways of thinking around the pressure and having private sector pretty much pick up some of those aspects of the deal without actually rewriting the policy but existing what current policy allows. And if one were to look at the amounts that are on the table in the inputs, and you use a rough figure of say 10% private financing of state activities, that can easily save system an order of 100 billion rand. And the minister spoke about 50 billion rand per year to avoid moving to energy, and by 30% carrying off state activities, private activities, you already have raised close to 100 billion if you think of it that way. So that, those are the things that come to mind or immediately around the area of state of the enterprise.
You done? If you go, and then there is my 15 minutes each.
Thank you, Chair. Chair, mine will not be very long. Chair, let me answer, there have been fundamental questions raised, but let me answer the questions this way, by starting off by saying, if you look at the presentations that were presented today, including the TVO, you've indicated, I think the picture you take away from here, is that we're in an economic downturn, a serious economic crisis. We have high debt, there's no growth, there's unemployment, we won't be able to redistribute. And you know we have this policy through redistribution, we won't be able to go. So those two objectives are not there. The NTDPS basically seems like carrying on from the same thing. Then nothing has changed. We've had this for years. If we cut expenditure and we hope to go, in this case we cut it and we won't even stimulate development. Are you addressing this issue, Chair? Is this the question you should ask yourself is this the policy direction the finance committee wants to take? Do you want to end it? Because you have the power to do it. Or is this a continuation of what you want to take forward as the finance committee? That's a fundamental question I think you should take away from here going forward. Is this the policy direction you want? Much of the same in this regard.
So, for example, the issues that you raised here, there were basically six issues. Wage assumptions, which are assumptions that come from NTPPS, these are not our assumptions. You raise taxation issues, you raise issues about SMEs, inflation targeting, you raise issues on local government. Now, under the process here is very different. I mean, if I was me, from a personal perspective, as an economist, coming from a very theoretical, different theoretical perspective, I would say, why would you want to cut wages? Wages stimulate the economy. The private sector is developing, is not providing employment. So why do we have to cut public sector spending in terms of wages? Because the more you do that, less people are employed, and you give them less tax to pay. So that's the example of an ideological kind of approach. SOEs, there's an approach which says you need SOEs because they're less market rates. Yes, they have a dual objective. They have a commercial objective and they have a developmental objective, but are you willing to sacrifice it in some cases? So it's a specific ideological approach, theoretical approach will take. And this is a discussion which you as a committee need to say, this is what we want to go for. Are you prepared to reduce debt? In some countries they say, well, our debt levels are not high. What's South Africa going to do? You know, we can still go into more debt, we can borrow more. Why should we tax people? So these are issues here. I think that when you learn these presentations, you guide us in terms of saying, as a committee, how do we take this initiative forward? Now you raise fundamental issue of taxation. So you should, for example, say, shouldn't we as a committee maybe be saying, what's the taxation measures that we can introduce to assist this process? What's the policy direction with respect to inflation targeting? Do we still have to maintain it between 3 and 6%? And there's a lot of debate which says, well, you don't have to keep it between 3 and 6%. You can improve it to say 9, because you get more job creation. So these are the kind of debates and discussions I think that you want to guide us on. And the PPO chair is not the stakeholder here. It's your institution. You tell us what to research, and the research we run this every time you come here by presenting to you that you think we're one of the outsiders out there that you must interrogate. We are your arm. If you want us to say, we want you to investigate the budgets of SOEs and we want you to tell us why these guys are business or they're good, that we should give to you. So we run the risk here every time you come and present because you can't find any other presenter. That we find, that we're in this kind of situation in this regard. So what did you take away from here, Chair? You took away from this presentation that you, as a committee, have no clarity on what the MPDPS policy direction is. Do you want it to continue or not? Do you want to amend it? Because you have no authority to do it, Chair, as members of Parliament. Do you want to tell the minister we don't agree? Because if you cut waste bills, you're going to destabilize the economy. If you cut local government resources and funding, maybe you should think about reorientating the provinces. Maybe they are the domain in this regard. It's a political issue. It's a structural issue which you need to address. So, Chair, I think there's a lot of fundamental issues raised. Differently, if you want recommendations, we can give the recommendations at the PBO. And we might come from different ideological perspectives and theoretical perspectives. And we'll have to debate it with us in that regard. So, my point is there, do you want to continue with this trajectory that you've been presented with? Are you happy with it? Is it the right policy direction? Or are you going to change it? Thank you, Chair.
I know you don't know something.
That's just a comment. Or not an objective. Nonetheless, I at least understand the role of the PPO. Or maybe it's different from what I thought it is. Because the PPO, from where I'm sitting, should do a gentle approach to it. Coming with some recommendations where they think that maybe the NPPS is weak. And then the committee consider those recommendations based, of course, on their assumption. That's the simplest definition that I'm giving out of there. And I'm really surprised, they're okay. It's more of a summary of what is here, but also what is their take on it, which is fine. But when I said, they are very short in terms of telling us what is that thing we need to do realizing our mandate as entities, you know. So that's exactly what I'm expecting. What I did just now from Prophet, I would very much anticipate the leadership recommendations from the PP. I mean, I think that the team must be very friendly first and ensure that I mean, we get sound recommendations and advice from their side. Without the family, I mean, beating about the question. Thank you.
Although Tom Wayne was very clear on that point, of an image.
You know, I'm hearing what Prof is saying, and I'm appreciating everything that he's saying. However, I'm yet to hear the recommendations around our ability to service our loan account. And secondly, I'm yet to hear how best are going to address the issues of productivity in this country. Because they have become so, they are so in heaven to a point where it's becoming very difficult to think objectively. And probably those are the kind of things that I would love to hear from Paul. Thank you.
I'm pleasure, Honorable Tobias.
Chair, to me it sounds like wants to give the PBO the responsibility to take policy decisions. And I just get what people say that. And when we do that, we actually abdicating the responsibility as members of parliament to decide exactly what we want to do, empowered by the legislation that we have in place. If we want to take a different approach, it's our responsibility. The PBO must research and say, here is a different opinion. You decide what you want to do with that opinion. Unless you want them to participate in a position, I don't know whether we will be able to do that. I actually was a Dems advocate when said the FFC must actually come into that space and start to make recommendations. It doesn't, or a lack of a better opinion, given the frustrations of dealing with the same matters over and over again. And say, that's a different approach. Maybe if we can engage each other face to face and say, but this one will not work. Let's try a new one. With our stakeholders. Now we shift the responsibility to our support. I will say support is our goal. So the president advises us. They say, look at these issues. You decide what decisions you want to take. And I think we should end this discussion somewhere else. And then come. They cannot be the ones that make recommendations on our behalf. We should take that responsibility. They will make the presentation. They will, the same way that the FSC and the Reserve Bank will say, look, we have a different opinion. Here's our opinion. We take the responsibility. Thank you very much.
They can give us different scenarios. It's our responsibility when we deal with a report to make the recommendation on what scenarios. Ask that.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I must state that the input you got from Prof. Zahir was very direct, straight, and to the point. And I'm grateful for that. I'm grateful because you have actually gone for the heart of the matter. You have actually said to us as a committee, what is our oversight role? How much of that oversight role are we pushing? Are we pushing it hard enough? Or are we pushing it behind yourselves? So that it actually looks as if you are doing most of the work and we are behind you. Thank you very much for what you stated and how you actually made that statement and all those issues which you brought forth. May I state that I definitely do agree with the Honourable Tandy that the recommendations need to come from us. That is part of our oversight role. We cannot hide behind ourselves in a manner in which where we need to address a direct difference from what the minister has said, and then we hide behind you. It is us who are saying it as part of our oversight. We need to say it directly. That is what the chairperson of my standing committee on finance said earlier when he gave his input. I would just like to say to that, I'm extremely grateful for what you have said. You have actually ruffled us, and you have made a statement which are very serious, which are saying to us, we can't hide behind you, let us do our job as members. members of parliament. Thank you.
I also refer honourable members to section 15 of the Moneyball Act, referring to the role of the PBO. That is very clear. Last dance. Last because Chief Co-Chair then, because we've got a time problem.
Chairperson, just to show my appreciation also towards the input from Professor Zahe. Certainly, I think there's a complete consensus that needs significant interventions. And I think that is the mindset that the prophet like us today. So we will take this into consideration. And I think we've made some very bold propositions on our behalf, what we would like to see change. And we'll take those to the committee and we will have a robust debate on those issues. But taking the fiscal constraints and the crisis that you've mentioned, certainly it is absolutely the time, thank you for your recommendations, that there should be bold interventions in terms of pricing, as Professor also mentioned, in terms of how ESCOM does the application to NERSA, or NERSA proposes in terms of inflation-related prices. Now, ESCOM comes with a different scenario in terms of the pricing should be done across the cost-effective tariff. Whether it includes the new build or not, that's a question. If NERSA is committed to inflation-related prices, it excludes the new build cost. And those are the practical issues that we in the committee will address, which has a significant and a profound effect on people of all levels in society. So thank you very much for those proposals, and I think we have been into it with an open mind, but with consensus that there's a crisis and that we need significant interventions and bold recommendations to address the fiscal deficit of 4.1%.
Okay.
No, I mean, I don't think there's a conflict between two strands of approach here, actually. You see, what you have offered as PBO is an overview of the MPBS. You simply filed sort of any implications. But you haven't actually proposed what you as a PBO as a holding, whichever understand the law, allows you to do. However, ultimately, you know, it doesn't, I'm happy, if it's, the law doesn't allow it, I'm happy to personally receive it, and there may be members who may be happy to personally receive it. However, the final decision has to be made by us. I don't think that asking the support staff to extend the parameters of their work and score what they do is a crime. What would be a crime is for us to abdicate our responsibility. Yeah. For all the discussion here, as I try to communicate in the committee and serve, the final test is what's down in the recommendation session of the report, and more crucially, what is done from the day the report adopted to the next MCDPS. Those are the real tests. So people can say whatever they want. They can be eloquent here. The intellectual quality of what they say may be rich. See, what value does it carry unless you have clear recommendations on a page, which is why I hope they can under appeal. But this thing of 25-page reports that nobody bothers to read, the days are over of that. I mean, lobbying, and as far as I know, the majority parties agree. Reports, I've been feeding with them. A report, in my view, let me repeat, should be more than 4 pages. 1 page at most, an overview. And the remaining piece is, what does the committee feel? Now, this is our first engagement with PBO. So I think what we will do is, once we get the content advice, let's say by the year 2040, we will then say, okay, I'll bring this, what is the role of the content advisor? What is the role of the researcher, right, who's on a very long return to leave, I might add, I don't know how long it is, because she's been away for a very long time. And then, that's not British, she's not our research advisor, she's our research coordinator. And then what is the role of the committee secretaries? So, what is your role? We've discussed it, haven't we? We said as soon as we get everybody, we're going to have a meeting. But I think once we have a meeting, we will report to the committees. But I don't think anything stops you. And if the rules don't allow it, and the law doesn't allow it, hey, send it to me personally. Then I will speak to you. In other words, if I agree with you, I'll raise the point. So I don't think there's anything wrong, but we must be utterly clear. It is the committee that decides. And the final change is the report. Only we vote on the report. Only we vote on the report.
I noted on Professor Chahed, then your colleague there, then we have to go to the reserve bank.
I want to make one point just to indicate to you an issue on recommendations. Then I think the idea of a PBO recommendation of stakeholder enterprises. And a lot of it has been written about it in South Africa and internationally. Now, my view in terms of state-owned enterprises, not as an academic, and as looking at international disputes, and here's my recommendation on state-owned enterprises, for example, from the panel, Uncle Chief. State-owned enterprises
pseudo enterprises are brought into the economy because there's a market failure. So you create a DVSA because no institution provided infrastructure financing in the country. One point. No financial institution wanted to play in the space of infrastructure financing because not worth money testing. So what do we do as a government? We create the DVSA. And we said, here's some money, you go out there, you create bridges, roads, local government infrastructure at soft interest. And the reason we created the DVSA theoretically was because there was a market failure, isn't it? Banks didn't want to play it in that field. Once the DVSA, which is now is done, has fulfilled a role, it's played a significant role in creating infrastructure, the banks are now saying, but DVSA, you know, why is the playing in this space? We can now fund infrastructure. We're doing cheaper than you are doing. And the market failure process is once the state of the enterprises addresses the market failure, it then closes down and moves away.
I'm worried about what we're doing. I'm very worried about what we're doing.
Honourable members, I need your assistance, please.
All I'm doing here is I'm giving you an example of how you approach a recommendation. That's all I'm saying. So I can come with that recommendation to the committee. We can then discuss it, and then it's up to you to say, this is the role we take, or this is the role we don't take in this regard. That's the difficulty of making recommendations.
Is that okay?
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. I will be brief. I'm just going to group some of the questions together. So there are several questions about trade and imports. Essentially, what's happened after the crisis is that our BRICS partners' export performance improved very quickly, and they recovered their export volumes very rapidly in the wake of the crisis, and South Africa didn't. And so when you calculate market share statistics, you would find that South Africa's market share relative to BRICS has declined. And there are a variety of reasons why that may be the case. But certainly, in our view, we have commented on the competitiveness of the South African economy being not what it should be, as well as the very high proportion of commodities that are exported, the demand for them has weakened in recent years. On the issue of why imports are so large, it's related to this. Obviously, you can break down our import bill into two groups. Capital goods and intermediate goods, which make up about 75%, and then consumption goods, which make up about 25%. And in each of those areas, imports have grown quite strongly on the back of some investment. Certainly, state-owned enterprise investments is responsible for a lot of the intermediate and capital goods imports. But it's also the case that the rand is appreciating, that the nominal value of our imports rises. So some of that increase in the nominal import bill is a function of the currency weakness. And oil prices have been quite high. They've come off recently, but we still haven't seen that decline in oil prices come into the import numbers yet. It will at some point, in particular if oil prices stay low for a while. But oil prices have been quite high for quite some time, and that's tended to push up the import bill. Issues around what's the top problem affecting the growth forecast, and around whether or not the forecasts are likely to come true, and are we really picking up? Looking backward, it's quite clear that the platinum strike had a very negative impact on the first and second quarter GDP numbers. So if I look backward, I say the strikes had a massive impact. We calculated it at about 1.6% of GDP, and it drove the economy to contract in the first quarter of the year. The longer term, I think, issue is more about confidence. So if we ask ourselves whether or not we think the forecast is going to be realized, a lot of it has to do with just the household consumption spending and investment decisions made by South Africans, and we worry a lot about the confidence in which they do that. So they think about the future, and if they're uncomfortable about the future direction or a future economic, future income stream, then they may make decisions that you don't want them to make about investment spending. The other factor that plays a really large role in whether or not a forecast comes true is just global GDP. So I spent quite a bit of time in the beginning of my presentation talking about the IMF forecast and how these things were systematically taken down, and obviously they really do have a very large impact on where we go. The other factor that I tried to highlight is commodity prices and the terms of trade. In the last 15 years of the commodity price boom, South Africa has benefited from a huge price windfall to benefit the economy. With commodity prices falling, the terms of trade softening, that windfall to the economy is dissipating, and it's dissipated relatively quickly. On the hierarchy of risks, well, global GDP, domestic inflation outcomes are very important to drive. If inflation goes out of the target, it drives up our interest rates and weakens the currency further, generating a feedback loop that's very negative. We worry quite a lot about food prices, particularly global food prices. Recently, they've come down as along with oil prices, so there's some good news there. But in terms of a hierarchy of risk, global GDP, inflation, the currency, and then back into the domestic confidence issues are really important. I've got nothing to say about domestic challenges. There's the National Development Plan, there's the New Growth Path. Those are all speak directly to those issues, I think, in more useful way than I can. On the question of public sector wages, look, I think it's complicated, but generally speaking, we would say when public sector wages rise above the inflation target, it puts upward pressure on the inflation rate, and we think that's a bad thing for achieving the inflation target. But there are mitigating factors that you have to look at. The public sector wage bill is only 20% of the economy's total wage bill. There are issues involved, as Mr. Kamala pointed out, around changes to the composition of the wage bill. So salaries might go up, but the number of jobs that are actually in that wage bill may change. And obviously, labor productivity for the sector workers will have a big impact on the inflationary impact of any public sector wage settlement. So if productivity rises, all else equal, it tends to reduce the inflationary impact. Else I didn't cover. I think that's about it. Thank you.
To the Reserve Bank, I'll just a quick follow-up on the members.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. I don't want to get into the debate about who or what, where policy should be set, whatever case is, but simply what is clear is that it is this country's job to make sure that we have a look at what's been put on the table in front of us in terms of the NGPPS and then make our recommendations. Now, the Budget Office has certainly walked into a very important debate that needs to be had, and that talks about structural defects in our economy. Now, when the Minister was talking about the state-owned enterprises, it was very clear that we cannot afford to carry on paying for dysfunctional enterprises. And therefore, we need to look at how we're going to fix that problem. Now, it's 100% correct that if there's a market, government must intervene when the market fails, because it is not perfect. So government intervenes, and then it attempts to correct that failure. When the failure goes away, something else comes into play, then you reassess your position. But what becomes apparent in our economy is that there is a network of privilege and corruption that doesn't go away. And we need to address that. So this committee needs to get quite serious about the problem we have in this economy. Yes, it's in fact a crisis. And if we're ever honest, we will have a major problem next year. We'll see massive tax increases and our economy will become unsustainable. And that's not good for anybody, especially the poor on whose behalf we speak. So therefore, I think we must have those debates. We should have them here. And we should start on things like the failure enterprise that chuck the money out of our economy at a rate that is just mind-boggling. So on that note, I will stop. But I'm looking forward to a very interesting debate when we put together the report to Parliament. Because if we carry on doing the same old thing, we're going to end up with the same old result. Thank you very much.
Honourable Khoza.
Chair, I just wanted to emphasize the point that we are not expecting the Parliamentary Budget Office to pronounce on policy issues. But what we are expecting is for the Parliamentary Budget Office, because we carry a research capacity,
to present different scenarios and the implications of each scenario, so that as policymakers we are then able to apply our mind on the basis of those scenarios that would have been presented to us. Then we can take this decision, but we are not in them and take this decision.
You captured it 100%. 100%. Order. Just put off that mic on this desk, please. Just put off the mic, please.
No, I was saying a great
question. If finance interacted with the anti-corruption task team in terms of our role referring to the intervention of Popo, and we can take this forward that we can have a joint meeting calling the ACT in terms of their role cracking down on corruption and cases. That's another way forward. Thank you, Mr. Lowell. Are there any other short one?
Yeah, very short one. You always do that, Nietzsche. Well, thank you very much from the gentleman from the Reserve Bank. Well, I just want to make a comment. I was saying, let me put it this way. One of the major determinants of whether or not a policy compensation target would succeed is in its ability to be able to anchor people's inflation's expectations within or around the inflation target itself. While what you're saying is correct, you're spot on. All the factors that one has to consider when it comes to what would actually push the inflation rate to beyond the table target, but it is critical that we're able to anchor people's expectations. And if one considers, you know, what happens during the bargaining period, and that then the focus is actually always about the inflation rate, and it may to a certain extent might influence people's expectations. I know that we can control that by interest rates and other instruments that are available to you. But I want to also comment briefly on the issue that was mentioned by Honorable Marcos. This is quite 100%, but if we were to put 10 economists in this room, I'm sure we'd get 10 or 11 or 50 different recommendations. Thank you.
Yeah, that's the reality. Uncle Karim?
I think if I understand main thing that's emerging from this meeting, and maybe I've got it wrong, and so we don't go back to discussing these things, we actually move forward. I think what is being said is that nothing stops the PBO or the research unit or any support services unit from proposing various options, spreading out the implications. That's their work. No one's shamed you from doing it even this time around. It is ultimately our decision. Never before have I seen the community where any researcher has dictated to us. We ask them for help because they have some technical experience some of us don't have. I speak for myself in particular, so people don't answer, I don't have. So I like it if more technically competent people. But ultimately these are political decisions. So the committee will decide, so let's have this discussion again. But we do need that, but in Parliament's management, I need to alert the committee. I've raised the Parliament four times now. If once we clarify this role, they themselves are better. What is the role of the content advisor and the researcher? There's huge tussles taking place even 5 years later. Now you come on the scene, and the PBO, and then now until the committee seeks to venture right reports and all that, so that will be resolved, right? And we will report back to you early in the new year. The second thing to say is that we should be very wary, I think, all the way around, to say things like, I think the second thing that's emerging, and yes, there's disagreement, the majority wants you to do work on the state-owned entities. Close from the MCBPS. What is commercial, what is developmental, how are we can separate them, all those issues. So what I suggest, if there's agreement on that, both committees, if members can submit, say, what's today? Today's Tuesday. By next Monday, to the respective secretaries. Proposals of what we think are some of the questions on state-owned entities that you should actually work on. Another issue that seems to arise, I don't know if this is something the members will agree, I don't know how much of capacity you have. Because this issue of the public sector wage bill is going to be highly contested, not least within the majority party's alliance, maybe we can also try to put some ideas together in terms of reference on a research project. This is something that will be ongoing. Then what I also want to say is, yes, I agree that we should have a meeting on the state-owned entities, but not without the state-owned and public enterprise portfolio committee and committee being here. Because what we should avoid is actually like flipping the role of the relevant line function simply because the money comes from here doesn't mean that therefore we should decide for other portfolio committees, especially because these are policy, ideological, political, and other issues. First, we first decide what you mean by development of states, given the crisis we are, or challenges we are experiencing, what is the role of SOE? Then decide about money. To start from here, from finance committee, and say, because we've got an economic crisis, therefore, it's our way around, I imagine. If you look at the role of the SOEs, given the NDP in, and all of that, NGP and whatever else, then you decide, bearing in mind that we've got a crisis, economic and financial, how do we now tweak the role we have in mind for them? So I'm slightly worried about this thing that keeps coming up in the standing committee. People say, okay, it's to do with this matter, let's discuss this here. No, no, we can't, because the chair of that committee and the whip and the committee was going to ask you, hey, who are you people to decide about this, or these are staying there? So what I suggest is you do this work, that Dave and myself speak to the SOE committees, and we ask them also to make proposals to you. So the PDO, at that stage you say you're serving finance committees, but you can't be on the public enterprises committee. So I would suggest that you and I speak possibly in the House, to our side, you speak to your side, and we ask them to make submissions to you as well. So by Monday afternoon, 4 o'clock, you look at what we've done in the term of reference or questions, and move, and then bring all the committees together, the two finance committees and the two public enterprises committees, and we give you a deadline. Realistically, we can't do it, sir, colleague. So shall we say, at the beginning of next year, that committee meets before Parliament plenary sits, that's the time we look towards your efficiency report. How about that?
That is an excellent wrapping up of this session of the Select Committee for Finance and the Standing Committee and Select Committee. Honourable members, we thank the FFC, PBO and the Reserve Bank for their presentations in a certain way to stir the pot. That's also our role in Parliament, just to give us that appetite. Honourable members, the next engagement of the Joint Committees will be on Thursday at 12:30 in room M315, just to the Secretariat. I hope there's enough space in this committee room. That concludes the business of the meeting. The meeting is adjourned. Thank you.